Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Just for anybody, because I know some people said that they knew people, even knew some black people who just said, hey, this is just entertainment. You know, you all are talking nonsense. This is just good old Hollywood fun. You get your popcorn and go enjoy. Nobody is thinking about doing this for real. And this does not, you know, impact. Certainly, they're not going to have any really authorized government purging where people are allowed to go out and commit crimes, much less murder people. Certainly that's not going to happen. I would say, one, on this website that they put up, which you can still access the archives, it says One Night to Save America, and it's got the Statue of Liberty in the background. It almost reminded me, somebody has a slogan that says Make America Great Again. I cannot think of where that comes from. That's one. And then two, you did hear in the beginning, I did play a clip from the film, which Dr. Kevorkian mentioned. I also played two authentic news clips. One was a waitress who was fired in Colorado, where she went online and posted that she wished that there was one night to purge. She would kill as many Mexicans as possible because they didn't tip her well. And then there was Jonathan Cruz, a 19-year-old white male in Indiana, who said he was inspired by this film, killed three people. He's now facing the death penalty. This was months ago. This is not ancient history. Both of those incidents happened within the last 2 months. Jonathan Cruz is facing the death penalty. It's stated in the Washington Post that he had a particular level of contempt for black people. Again, it didn't say people of color, didn't say non-white people, it didn't say black and brown people. Black people, and one of the people that he killed was a black male, unarmed black male that he just saw. Oh, I think I'll kill him. Bang, shot him dead for no reason. Called him some racial slurs, according to the report that was in the Washington Post, and then moved along. I think that is hugely important. And those are just two incidents that I could pull in terms of people who think that, oh, this is just entertainment and this, you know, is not communicating any messages, certainly not encouraging this way of thinking. Any comments, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, first I want to say I recommend looking at that article in the Washington Post. Thank you for sending me the link to that. And it was just so striking that, in fact, this man in Indiana had used those racial epithets in such a clearly targeted manner, that he was taking this as an expression of his hatred that was very much racially, purely racially charged. You mentioned that, you know, that there's the slogan, someone has a slogan, you know, Make America Great Again. I did think that this resonated with a lot of the messaging that is coming from that campaign, and the messaging that is resonating with angry white men, young men who see themselves as disenfranchised. I can't remember now which of the films it is, but there's one of the new founding fathers whose name is, I think, Donald Talbot. He's on screen. Did you catch that detail?
I did not. I will have to check as we're going.
There's someone definitely his initials were DT. I can remember. I might have the first name. There's D was the first name, and Talbot was the last one. But DT was his initials, and he was clearly one of the new founding fathers. He's one of like the talking heads that you see on the television at one point. And I'll just say that, you know, that, you know, that slogan, you know, make America great again. I mean, it's terrifying, you know, the idea of turning back the clock, that there was some golden age when things were so great. You know, one of the things I think that is, what's strange about that campaign and strange about the movie is that it seems to be so much about portraying in the movie the bloodlust of these wealthy white Americans. On the other hand, when you think of that campaign, what the polls are showing is that DT's biggest lead is among what, you know, pollsters might categorize as less educated or uneducated white men. And this is a Pew survey that I read about. And they say it's not even about, most people think it's talking about the economy, but they said that these are white people really who see themselves outside of the system of privilege, that white privilege is not benefiting them, and that they don't like two things. They don't like immigrants. They don't like the idea that people are coming from outside of America and changing it. And they also say that they specifically feel like they don't like the idea that soon so-called minorities will be in the majority, that they see that as a negative trend. And they see this political leader, DT, as someone who feels the way they do. And I'll just say that, you know, this is a movie franchise that is, you know, puts on screen what that desire looks like, to reduce that sector of the population, the minority portion of the population.
Even put me down, I'll still be there for you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, November 28th, 2016. So I have been told. Broadcast for today. Make sure I get it said at the outset. Reading is more important than watching television. I'm not trying to encourage anyone to, you know, go find new things to waste time. We have a lot of problems, particularly black people, all non-white people in the system of white supremacy. We should have much greater priorities in terms of how we invest our time and energy than vegging out on Netflix or whatever the case is. I really want to emphasize the whole point of any of the programs that we do, where we are analyzing film, television, is to deconstruct some of the messages in this content that, in my view, reinforces racism, white supremacy, how we view black people, how we view and think about individuals classified as white. I think a lot of this, sometimes the messaging can be directed at whites to encourage them to practice racism, white supremacy, or the upgrades, if you will, the refinements in terms of new changes, new directions, and how the plantation will be managed. I think a lot of it happens in that manner, but that's always the main point of emphasis. What can be learned from these films? How do these films promote, support, maintain the system of racism, white supremacy, and maybe some elements that people miss in terms of either these are films that you haven't seen or maybe products that you have not thought about in depth. With that, I will also emphasize, particularly for anyone who says, why on earth is Gus wasting time talking about this goofy sci-fi television, British no less, television series? Why on earth would you be talking about that at a time like this with President Trump, President-elect Trump, waiting in the wings to take power and all of the things that are happening all around the world, Fidel Castro and his transition just in Cuba, all of the things that are happening, why would you be focused on this? And I would say we were so far ahead of the curve on Donald Trump. You heard at the beginning of the program, our guest for today's program, that was our discussion from August. I think we've been very clear and for a long time about Donald Trump and what was going to happen with the election, predicting a lot of these things. And in fact, being so accurate with our film choice, we haven't done a whole lot of television programs But The Purge was one film set that we selected, and the introduction that you heard for this program was pretty much the reason why I thought that was such an important film and represented the zeitgeist of the times in terms of how you knew this was going to happen in terms of Donald Trump winning the election and what that signifies about racism, white supremacy, bloodlust, I think was the term that was used in how we are moving forward 2017 in the wings. The film or the television series we're reviewing today, Black Mirror, came out in 2011. It's on Netflix. It was a British series, got picked up by Netflix in season 3. Fascinating series, one of the most challenging that we will discuss here on the program. I'm super excited. Joining us once again, the last time we heard from him this past summer, we discussed The Purge. We've discussed a lot of films over the years, Pulp Fiction, Hancock, Nothing But a Man, some real gems, in my opinion, down through the years in deconstructing racism, white supremacy. We also have discussed his book, Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America, and fascinating text in particular, fascinating text in relation to the series that we are going to discuss today. Always a hoot having him on the program, joining us live once again, University of Texas Austin professor, Dr. Martin Kevorkian. Dr. Kevorkian, are you with us, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you for that very warm welcome. Can you hear me, sir?
Loud and clear. Glad to have you back with us. Yes, sir.
Yes. I just want to say thank you for always providing a context for constructive conversation. And I do appreciate that shout out for reading. That's dear to my heart. And I hope your listeners take it to heart as well.
For sure. Double underline that, highlight, boldface print. Reading is more important than watching television. Before we get started, I'm sure this might be some folks' first time hearing from you on the program. Anything that you think folks should know about who you are, the work you do?
Well, let's see. I've benefited from participating in a number of these conversations with you, and they do, for what I've been trying to contribute, follow up with a lot of the work that I did and continue to follow up on for the book that you mentioned, Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America, in which really is very much of a piece with a lot of the things that we see in Black Mirrors, which is, if I could try to say it most simply, that negative attitudes, negative white attitudes about technology are equated with negative white attitudes about Black people. And I think it's right there even in the title of Black Mirror, that kind of negativity towards both the technology and towards Black people. So yeah, that's the book's been out for a while, and it's growing old, and but I maintain research interests in this area of representations of race and representations of technology. So that's what I'm about. I say that the book is the press wanted to get rid of a whole bunch of copies, so they sent them to me very, very cheap. So I don't know if I've got a finite supply, but if any of your listeners want to email me, I will send you a copy, because they're not doing anyone any good. If you're interested, I'm sincere that I'm mkevorkian at utexas.edu, and if you want to shoot me a line and an address, I will mail you a copy of the book for as long as those discarded copies remain.
Oh, well, you can sign Gus T up. I would like an autographed copy. Add that to the library. That would be great. And I would encourage, I've said this before, I do not encourage non-white Black people purchasing books that whites have written about racism. I think it is disgraceful for whites to benefit from the system of white supremacy by putting out, and most of the times, the rule generally has been that most of these books that whites write about racism are not very good or are not even accurate. This is one that I do think is very interesting, and I have pointed back to this one quite a few times in just that theme. This is such a great series to kind of reference and think about. His book, the black color monitors, the black face of technology in America. I didn't even make the connection at first because this is such a bizarre film series. I didn't really know what I was getting into when I watched the first one. But wowee, you are best qualified person to speak to this issue. So I would encourage listeners, follow up, get a copy of the book, check it out. I did one question before we hop into the television series, since you are an English professor by trade. I did want to ask one question pertaining to words and definitions. One of the things I have kind of picked out, prompted our listeners and guests about, if you ask for a definition for a term and someone, they give you an example and as opposed to a definition, I have cautioned people to say you should really make sure you get a definition and not an example. They are not the same thing. When you look in the dictionary, they do give you an example of the word that you're looking for, but that's after you have the definition so that you can understand the essence of the term that you're looking up or that you're trying to question, as opposed to just having an example, that those are not the same thing. And that I found a lot of times when you request people to explain a term, they can give you an example. They cannot give you a definition. Is that something people should pay attention to, or am I kind of talking crazy?
No, I think that is absolutely true. I'll just say it's often very challenging to give a precise definition, and that's why sometimes people evade it. But it's very much worthwhile to try to get a real definition. You might say, you know, the people who make the dictionaries are sometimes they're coming up with that definition by looking at many, 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 many examples, right? But not just one example. So yes, you're right. You get the definition first, and then you get all the examples. But it's also the case that that definition should represent a whole bunch of examples.
Absolutely. And part of that, I have found a lot of times when people give you an example, sometimes they don't give the best example for the term where a definition is being requested, and that can have a huge impact. Now, sometimes people can supply a great example so that you got it. You still should have a definition, but if they can give you a great example, fine. But I've just found a lot of times, especially when we are talking about racism, the example is not the A-plus example. It is just not. And I would submit sometimes that people deliberately give a poor example so that you do not get a quality overstanding of the term. Very important, I submit. Anything else you need to add on that before we get to Black Mirror?
No, I mean, I just want to say I appreciate the care that you've encouraged me to take with my own use of language. I mean, you've had, even from the very first show, you had some helpful critiques of the book, and people should keep this in mind when they read it, that a lot of times I use a kind of that theory word, the other or others, when really what most of this analysis is talking about, this book is quite simply not some vague abstract other. It's talking about attitudes about Black people in most of these, and almost all the examples that I'm examining in that book. So that's one example where I was using a kind of vague terminology. I'll tell you, you led off the last show by emphasizing the use of the word fair and treating people fairly, as that is used in the Purge series, and noting that not just the definition of that word, but also the history of that word. That's another thing to sometimes is useful to get in the picture. You point out that the term fair equates light skin with justice. You say something is fair, it's really referring to someone with light skin. And there are many examples in the Purge series of white people trying to form contracts to each other by saying, let's treat one another fairly. Right? And then, as you point out, that's kind of a code word for, you know, what's the colloquialism? Well, that's mighty white of you, that kind of talk. And I noticed even in that same show, even later in the show, I caught myself, I used the term fair. I think someone asked me a question. I said, well, that's a fair question. You know, it's these habits are very ingrained and they're hard to break, but talking carefully about the definitions and the histories of words can be very helpful, and it can make me more aware of my own way of thinking about these questions.
Right on. Just to emphasize, again, going back to the purge, how ahead of things we were. We can talk about other things other than Trump now because we were pretty spot on with all of that. Even the use of the term purge within the context of the political election, we talked about that during the program and that term and how that became the title of the films. After Donald Trump won, there were a litany of articles with purge in the title where he was purging these people from White House consideration and purging this group and the same thing. Black voters purged and they couldn't vote in this area. It was just tons of them. I think I posted about three or four of them online within the first 7 days after the election, just further solidifying pretty much, I don't know, if not everything, the majority of what was discussed when we talked about that film during your visit this past summer. Moving to Black Mirror, I cannot emphasize for listeners, this is going to be very challenging because it's, for me at least, it's sci-fi. These are such bizarre episodes. I cannot think of anything, maybe than The Twilight Zone, and I've seen The Twilight Zone. This is quite a bit more strange than The Twilight Zones. These are not connected episodes, so you're not seeing the same characters, it's not following the same storyline. You could see absolutely anything in these episodes. Charlie Brooker, who's a white male, he is the writer for this series, which started in 2011. Again, this is a British television series. It is on Netflix, but that is a recent thing that just started in season 3, which just came out last month. So this was a British series. I don't get the impression that it had a huge following around the world or stateside the first couple of years, but it has started to become very popular. I think it's going to be a very popular show once more people in the States start to see how wacky all of this is. I think it's likely going to catch on. Do you want to just kind of give our listeners an idea of what this series is interrogating with technology?
Yeah, I get it, Tim. I'll say right off from the top that, you know, I thought just by comparison, I thought it was very important to talk about The Purge, primarily because it was so popular. I'd even say, you know, obscenely popular, just how much money it was making. With Black Mirror, the prime attraction for talking about it and its importance is so far that it has received, as far as I know, a lot of critical acclaim. The critics seem to be hailing it and I think overpraising it, but it's, you know, talking about it as a brilliant analysis of the human condition in a regime of technology. So, you know, no one's going to nominate The Purge for, you know, high art, but, you know, people who take television, you know, seriously are taking Black Mirror very seriously. And I'll say it comes, you know, primarily from a point of view that seems to take a very negative, one reviewer even called it a malignant view of humanity, and particularly a malignant view of humanity under the influence of technology. A lot of talk about social media and how that is enabled by technology. But I think that there's kind of overwhelming negativity to the series that makes it very easy for racial disparities to be masked within that. And we can talk about that as we get to the individual episodes. But I'm just trying to think about, you know, the fact that this has been very critically embraced by people who tend to think carefully about culture. But I, as far as I know, I haven't seen race being discussed a lot, but I think it's pervasive in the series. And again, I think it's pervasive. It's even goes to, I mean, I don't know, I guess I would maybe like your thoughts on that if I might presume, but, you know, I don't think every time the word black is used necessarily that it reflects a negative attitude about black people. But I think in the context of this show, when they call it Black Mirror, they're talking about technology being holding up kind of a mirror to society. And I think it's, you know, the conscious selection of the term black is meant to be negative. So right there, I'm sort of like, it's like the flip side of fair, right? If fair always meant just, and black means bad. But to me, it's not just about using the term black to mean bad. It does, throughout the series, use characters to equate black people either with technology or with things gone wrong with technology.
And again, going back to, I did not think this at first because just of how I arrived at this series, I was not prepared at all for what it is. So I was not originally connecting it with Dr. Kevorkian's work. But after I saw it and kind of got a better grasp of it, I was just like, wow, this is one that might, if you do an edited version, this might be something to add to the discussion, because I think this hits a lot of the themes in your book. And just getting right to the core, I mean, we can certainly interrogate the black characters in some of the episodes, and even just some of the white characters, how they behave and what have you. We could do that. But just the title of the series itself, and Charlie Brooker, again, this is the white writer, creator of this series. He says that he did this, he made this series to explore the dark side of our love affair with technology, and that dark side, that word again, it's been my experience. I think even some people might say that this, it being what they would call a dark series, or it has a lot of black humor in it, those type of descriptors, I don't think people a lot of times explicitly are trying to convey something about race, racism, or even black people. But I think the connotation is there within the global context. And you can just, in my view, you can just pay attention to how it evolves in the series. And I think with your book, really getting at some of the maybe subconscious layers of all of this, even when the complaints are lobbed about technology and problems it presents, this is supposed to be for our benefit, that a lot of times that easily fits onto the way that we have talked about black people being the technology. That's what a slave is, the original technology in this part of the world. Practice of racism, white supremacy being another form of technology. I think your book really gets at a lot of it, and I think it will come out as we discuss things within the series. I guess before I get to, and I don't even want to start with the first episode in the series, because that's not the experience that I had. I started with season 3, episode 1, which is kind of way down the road. But you said specifically, you think that in the series, there are specific times, more than one, where they are equating black people with technology?
Yes, I do. And I think, and they're specifically equating black people or aligning them. Even in that episode, Nosedive, there are black characters that are placed in consistently in the role of being in a serving role. I was struck when you led in to the show about sort of new rules for how the plantation will be managed. I think there's some plantation mentality in Nosedive, that the main character is a white woman, and she pretty much expects black people to be serving her, bringing her cappuccino or her coffee. But then she gets very upset when black people are not doing as she expects, like when the woman at the ticket counter will give her the ticket, and then she starts cursing and she gets in trouble, and then a black security guard shows up. I feel like all these people are, as her downward spiral begins, the black characters are like technology gone wrong. Just as technology is betraying her and technology is no longer serving her interests, similarly, these black characters who are, from her perspective, supposed to be serving her are also not serving her. That's what I saw in Nosedive. I don't know if you find that to be reasonable, but I mean, it's I will say, we don't have to talk a lot about the very first episode, the national anthem, but there's not a lot there with even characters of color, but there's a huge overall theme that's introduced there, which is white powerlessness in the face of technology. So many of these episodes, as you say, they're all over the map and they're strange and they're disturbing, but so many of them are about trying to make the viewer feel sorry for some main white character who is suffering from the technological regime. In the national anthem, it goes as far as even the prime minister, the ultimate sort of locus of white power. I mean, I'm not in the world, but I'm just saying in the British system is rendered powerless because of technology. And so I think a lot of these episodes are really complaints from the perspective of a white male about how the world is not running the way they want it to run now that technology controls things. But I think a nosedive is where one of the places where it shows up, that black people are equated with that technology that is not behaving in a way that the white principal character expects it to.
I think that's a great main theme, white powerlessness in the face of ever advancing and technology that was supposed to benefit them, that was there to further enhance their power, has run amok somehow and fouled up things for them. That I would submit, yeah, that is a major theme throughout all three seasons thus far of the series. I would only submit, I do think there are, and it's only 13 episodes, right? These are not seasons where you get like 10, 15 episodes. Season one is 3 episodes. So it's a relatively small amount of material over 3 seasons. But I would submit, I think there are enough episodes where you have white women are the ones who are, we're supposed to sympathize with, where things have gone that nosedive, for example, which is the first episode that I saw in the series. It was referenced by a listener, and she was kind of befuddled about what to make of all of this. So she questioned us to see if anyone had seen it, if we had any thoughts on it. I watched it, and the thing that struck me immediately, the white woman who is having her life ruined by social media, is Bryce Dallas Howard. Immediately, this is the white woman from The Help. Anyone who saw The Help, the white woman specifically, who is the overt racist, the main racist who is trying to keep Viola Davis and the other black maids from using the toilet in her residence. She's organizing all of the white wives to get this initiative passed. And they end up putting the toilets on her lawn as a big joke. That's the character from The Help, Bryce Dallas Howard. And I thought that was so important because I think that's going to end up being like a signature role for her. I think if you put her name in, The Help is going to be one of the top things that pops up on the page. And for this specific role, people have commented, who reviewed this episode, they commented about the colors. It has a lot of pastels. I know some of our listeners, they commented on the wardrobe and saying that it was kind of a retro, or at least her clothing was kind of retro-y. This is supposed to be a futuristic series that's looking at down the road, and she seemed like she was wearing things maybe out of the Help era, the 50s or 60s or something. The first time I watched it, right. The first time I watched it, my assessment was very much in line with your thinking, right? You've got all these black people in subservient roles. They're supposed to cater to her. They're at the coffee shop or the airport or wherever they are. And, you know, if they get on her nerves or what have you, or they rate her down or what have you, and it's just, oh man, this is so sad. And social media has done her wrong. It just fouls up her whole world. For whatever reason, it stuck with me, and I just continued to think about it. And I went back and I watched it again, and I said, wow, I think even at a deeper level, this might be a white lament about white people being attacked by black people on social media. Because even though these black people, like, we're not talking about black prime ministers, we're not talking about black presidents or CEOs, like, this, it's a black person working at a coffee shop. It's a black person working at the airport. Like, these are very low-level, non-powerful black people. But because of the technology, when this white person comes and she is being rude and nasty to them, and the taxi driver that she has, she's being loud and obnoxious in the car, just behaving like the typical white person would in a system of white supremacy, doing what white people would typically do, having no regard for these black people, their time. She spills her coffee on the black female on the way to the cab, just operating as a typical racist. But in this, the black people can retaliate. They just go on their social phone and ding her on social media, and she keeps getting hit. She keeps getting hit. It's the black people dinging her on social media that mess her up at the airport, so she can't get like the preferred seating because her rating has been lowered. And then it's the black people at the airport that, bang, get her the major ding where she can't get the car, and just everything falls. It's black people. And I thought, this is coming out at a time where you've seen so many white people attacked on social media where, oh, this person did something racist. Let's go online and find their Twitter account and find their social media and find where they work and boom, 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 and shame them online. Like, there's been so much of this over the last 2-3 years. I have heard white people complaining and saying, oh, this is terrible. And you've got all these PC police. Donald Trump even said some of that. You got all these PC police and you're just going to go online and try to shame us and ruin our lives. And this is a disgrace. That's what it seemed like it was conveying after I thought about it for, I think it took a couple of weeks. What do you think about that?
I think that's brilliant. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, you're right. I mean, it starts with the, you know, as you said, the cab driver can just ding her. Just, there's a kind of equality of power in that moment when people can just rate each other that way in this world, that there is a terror at the loss of that privileged position, that she can't just be annoying and rude in the cab without consequences. That she does feel victimized by a kind of PC police. You know, think about that also about in terms of, this is an episode that I was introduced to in another way. I read a review that said, you know, when Charlie Brooker wanted to bring Black Mirror to Netflix and to reach more of an American audience and a broader audience than have it just be a British show, one of the things that they were looking for was more upbeat endings. And this is one that, you know, was supposedly be one of the more upbeat episodes. And it occurs to me that at the end, you know, when she meets a character who is only known as, Man in Jail. Right, Man in Jail. This reminds me of Bloody Stranger, right, from The Purge, right? All these kind of underspecified black hair. But it's a black man in the jail cell next to her. And I think that the ending is supposed to be upbeat, but what happens is that Bryce Dallas Howard and this man basically just insult and start cursing at each other, and it escalates and escalates, and I think it's supposed to be like she's finally been set free and she's finally having this kind of cathartic moment, but I also feel like it's very much about Donald Trump's America and breaking free of the PC police. Like, at the end, she doesn't care anymore, and she is now free to insult this black man as much as she wants to. And that is portrayed as some kind of liberation or empowerment. And I think it's a kind of a lamentable thing that, like, the supposedly upbeat ending is that people get to curse at each other and insult one another. I mean, it seems to me like, this is what we heard throughout the Donald Trump campaign. I would just shake my head every time they would interview a Donald Trump supporter. And particularly the media would love to interview women who supported Donald Trump because they just couldn't understand. You know, how can you support Donald Trump given what he said about women, for example? And the thing that I heard Trump supporters saying over and over again is that he speaks his mind. He says what's on his mind. And I think there is that longing for that freedom to say whatever hateful thing is on one's mind that gets possibly played out in here. So I, Mr. Renegade, I don't know, I kind of went off on the conclusion there, but I think that that goes along with the humiliation of the earlier part of the episode that you are diagnosing as being about white people feeling resentful at being limited in their speech by the PC police, being limited by social media. Does that make sense, what I'm saying about trying to fit that ending with those earlier humiliations?
Oh, absolutely. I think that gets expressed explicitly within the episode, right? When Bryce Dallas Howard's character, when she hitches a ride with the white woman on the truck and she's saying all that, like, I'm liberated. You know, I wanted to just say what was on my mind. I don't care what, you know, that she could have been just snatching talking points right from president-elect. I mean, it's the exact same sentiment that I've heard from a lot of the white people who've been open enough to say that, yeah, I support Donald Trump. And this is why. This has been a bit, I think the New York Times, even, they've had some big pieces over the last couple of weeks that have echoed that exact same sentiment. And even I have seen a growing number of whites saying that I can't say anything. If I open my mouth to say anything, the flap with LeBron James and Phil Jackson from a couple weeks ago, where he referred to LeBron James' friends as a posse. And LeBron James felt that this was an act of racism, and he called it so. He said, I don't think he would have said this if he was talking about white people. He said this to us specifically because we're black. And by the way, he had done this twice. He had done this in a book as well. So it's not like he, if you're writing a book and call someone, use the word posse, you have editors and time to think and edit, presumably. So there was some premeditation at least once in saying posse. But there was all of this lamenting and hand-wringing where whites were saying, even here in Seattle, there was a white author for the Seattle Times. He wrote this big piece saying, you know, this is the exact problem that we have, and everyone's all afraid. If you say the wrong thing, then people are ready to just jump all over you and just start making accusations, and it's reckless, and I feel so bad for Phil Jackson. I hear a lot of that sentiment, and I think mm-hmm. that could be exactly. And the liberation that you speak of just being able to say, you know, F it, I'm going to say whatever I want to and speak my mind like our you know, incoming president. Did you one of our listeners, in fact, talking about this specific episode, and anyone, if you've seen the series, if you have questions about specific episodes, feel free to dial in. We'll get your thoughts also. One of our listeners about this episode, she said, could you ask Dr. Kevorkian, going with your analysis about white powerlessness in the face of technology, would also include having their pathology exposed through technology, if that makes sense. I would guess dash cams, some people might say, or everyone having a cell phone or a recording device or what have you. So now you can record people if they're saying something. Donald Sterling, right? Like, you got the recordings that you can share, this sort of thing. So now it's you have more instances where it's not just he said, she said. Now it's, well, I'm saying, and then I pulled out my iPhone and this is the recording I got. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a great phrase. They're having their pathology exposed through technology. Through the way that those images can be spread around. I think some of the other episodes get into the way that pathology is exposed through technology in kind of even mind probe sorts of ways. We can get to that later, perhaps, if we talk about playtests. But I think that some of the pathology of that white character's fears are exposed, and his racism is exposed in that episode. This idea that people cannot act, people of privilege cannot act without consequences, because now technology has been, not completely, but to a large extent, democratized, that there is the potential, it's not just the government watching us, the people can watch. When you have your little, those little mirrors that this series is so negative about, right? Calling them black mirrors, but there are also truth mirrors, right? And they can expose pathology. So I think your listener has given us a very helpful concept to work with there.
Context of white supremacy, Dr. Martin Kevorkian. I'm kind of backtracking. Like I said, this is such a bizarre series, and the episodes are not connected, really. So it doesn't really matter mm-hmm. the order, per se, that you go in, unless someone has picked out a pattern that I've missed. I don't have Netflix. Okay, so when I guess for a lot of people that have Netflix, they watch this, so you just see the content, and then you can go to the next episode or whatever you do as you watch. So when I watched this, I saw some of the streams as this aired, as some of the episodes aired originally on Channel 4 over in the UK. So one of the interesting things that happened along the way was you get promos, right? So as the episode goes off, they give you the promo for what's coming up next on television. So they did that during one of the episodes, and the promo ended up making a major point. I will play the sound clip just so that you can hear the promo, then I'll make my point and transition. Now, this is the end of the episode White Christmas, which we will talk about, which is, I think, a very important episode. That's from season 2. So this is the end of White Christmas. They're playing Christmas songs in the background. That's why. And so then it goes into the promo. It's like 30 seconds. Just pay attention. And then I'll give a thought afterward. Context of white supremacy. Oops. Wrong clip. Oh, wrong clip, sorry. Correct clip. Let's see. That's... Oh, I thought that was it right there. Folks will have to give me 1 second because I thought I had the clip already queued up to play. I will play it afterwards, so I'll do it in the opposite order for my clip. You'll have to hear the audio clip. It cannot be understated. This series started in 2011. The series National Anthem, that was the first episode in this series. Raping a pig on national television, getting a white prime minister, where he talks about this white powerlessness, getting a white prime minister. That's the whole plot of the episode, being blackmailed. We've kidnapped the princess, and you have to rape this pig on national television, or we're going to kill her. That's the threat. You have to do it or else. And they exhaust all their measures, and so this is gonna go down. I think that's so important for so many reasons. Presumably the first episode, that's often the pilot for a series. Sexual deviance seems to be a major theme throughout this series. Pedophilia comes up repeatedly in the series, and sexual infidelity, rape even comes up. Just what does that say to have this be the lead? This is the episode to introduce us to this franchise, a white male raping a pig. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the things, you know, I read in a lot of reviews is, well, you know, don't give up after the first episode, because it just was not something I think that a lot of people wanted to see. But I think it's almost like a satire on the audience. I mean, in other words, one of the objections you could make to this episode is, well, who would want to see the prime minister doing this to a pig? Which is the premise of the episode, is that everyone's watching this on social media and they are not paying attention to anything else. But on the other hand, it's kind of like the creator of the series saying, well, I got you to watch this episode and you're going to watch the rest of my series too. It seems to me that it's kind of playing a little bit of mind games with the audience in that way, just sort of saying, as happens to a lot of the other characters, people in these episodes again and again are asked to do ever more ridiculous things, and they keep saying yes. But I feel like it's almost also the case we're being asked to watch ever more absurd things, and for some reason we keep watching these episodes. Yeah. It was an episode where I probably would not have wanted to see that episode or keep watching had I not, you know, heard other things about the series. But I think, yeah, I think it is important for the reasons that you state.
Do you think, and I guess even before I ask my question for context, this series started in 2011. So this premiere episode came out in 2011 and the end of the year, like autumn 2011. So just for context, for this pig raping, and they don't call it raping the pig. That's me. No. They just say having sex with the pig. But I mean, we've been having a lot of conversations about consent. I'm going to say rape until they provide evidence otherwise. This all was released right at the moment when Jerry Sandusky was being arrested at Penn State, that's autumn 2011, for child rape that had went on for years, and the information just continues to come out. Now he's been convicted and is going to be in jail for the rest of his life, and evidence coming out that Joe Paterno, beloved football coach at Penn State, and others knew that this had been going on for decades and did nothing. And then across the pond, over in the UK where this series originated, Jimmy Savile, that was coming out simultaneously with Jerry Sandusky. Jimmy Savile, white man, Jerry Sandusky, white man as well. Jimmy Savile, white man who worked for the BBC, same thing, had been raping children for years as a BBC employee. Know what other people, evidence has also come out over the years that other people knew about this. Nothing was done about this. Same story happening at the same time when this series starts with man raping a pig. In some way, do we think this is promoting, trading in fetishizing all sorts of sexual deviance, bestiality, child rape, because, I mean, these themes are major elements in the series, yes?
Yes, they are. I mean, it comes up hugely again in, what's the one, Shut Up and Dance is the, one of the episodes where this pedophilia is a major plot point. The thing that I think, one thing I think is interesting is sort of the transformation from that real life context to the way that it's portrayed in that episode in the series. That you're talking about the Jerry Sandusky and the Jimmy Savile cases. I mean, these are cases of actual child rape where these men, you know, were guilty. One of the things I would find most interesting about that, the first episode of the National Anthem, especially in comparison to some other episodes, is that as far as I can tell, the Prime Minister hasn't been singled out for having done anything particularly wrong until he is compelled to rape the pig, right? So he is being held up as someone who is doing this sexual deviance, but nevertheless is being shown as someone who is innocent up until that point. And I think that's important in thinking about this. Someone else wrote about it. They said, you know, that this is essentially a horror series. And then horror series, you know, horrible things happen to people. But usually you take some pleasure in it if you find out that they somehow deserved it. I think that there's a huge racial disparity between, say, portraying the innocence, relative innocence of the Prime Minister up until he's, you know, forced into this act versus some of the other characters who are shown to be guilty, guilty, guilty. And I guess I'm thinking particularly of White Bear in that as a contrast to that. Another episode where, you know, the torture or molestation of children is central to it. But no, I had not thought about those real life cases in 2011 as being a really operative context. But it's
I think it's massively important. I think the point that you called out just now in terms of the Prime Minister in this series, where there's I wouldn't even know what you call it, where after he performs, after he rapes the pig, the before and after in terms of how he's thought about, how he's treated, that sort of thing, how things evolve versus some of the other characters. I'm very attentive to that sort of thing in terms of sexual deviance, because, I mean, there's so much of that. Jerry Sandusky, Jimmy Savile, this is real world, not, you know, whatever creations pop out on television. This is such a common element. And even right now, so we're having this discussion. Daniel Holtzclaw, the convicted rapist in Oklahoma, he was a former enforcement official, where they're having this big controversy. They have these billboards that have been placed up saying that he's innocent and all that. The sexual component is such a big facet of racism, white supremacy. That's something that I encourage folks to pay attention to. And I submit, I've seen no evidence that whites are doing things to convey that they're going to stop practicing racism. I see the same thing with the sexual deviance and just being very mindful that this could be promoting this sort of sexual pathology. And I have my clip now that I think is important because, I mean, it's so ubiquitous. I wish I had been able to play it correctly, but glad I got it nonetheless. So this is the end of White Christmas, which we haven't talked about at all, but that's season two. So that's concluding. And this is the promo that they give. That's what I'm saying, where this phenomenon, we've had white people from the UK on the program to talk about these two subjects together, racism and sexual deviance, and how the two just work together so nicely, because black people are already vulnerable. If I'm a sexual predator, why wouldn't I exploit black people? But this is the sound clip, and the two go together. That was the whole reason I was so stunned when I went back and listened to this portion over again. I had not paid close enough attention to what was being promoted. I just heard it was, oh, okay, this is another show that's coming on, you know, whatever. Next episode of Black Mirror. But I paid attention, and it was promoting a documentary that was coming on Channel 4. The documentary is called, or it's another British film series. It's called Manhunt. And it's search for a pedophile. You can, why it's online. You can check it out. Manhunt closing in on a British pedophile, but it's exactly what I'm saying. This white guy, he was going to Africa to rape black children. It's exactly what I said. And they were, that was being discussed as the White Christmas episode was going off. I have it up here. If it's going to be stubborn and not play, I'll just move on to the next one. But it's so huge. Hopefully I can get it to play before we move. But that's something I would encourage listeners to just think about and check out that documentary. If you have the time, the title again, it's Manhunt Closing in on a British Pedophile. And it actually aired on the same channel that this series originated on. The next series, I guess I'll pick out two other shows. And then if you have any specifics, I think you mentioned some already, then I'll nab some of our callers because we have quite a few callers who dialed in as well. You mentioned White Bear, and even going back to the language, you talked about the title Black being in the title for Black Mirror and the connotations, the way we think about racism, the way we think about black people. I have the same thought process with the term white when I just... I still didn't know a whole lot about the series, but when I just started looking at episode titles, White Bear and White Christmas stood out immediately. So I didn't watch these in order. I just looked at the titles and picked out, you know, what I was going to watch. So I watched White Bear. Wow. In a series of nothing but disturbing episodes and really cynical look at all of this together, I think this, at least for me, is the most disturbing of them all, if not being really high up there. It's kind of difficult to even explain what happens in the episode. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Kevorkian.
No, I just want to say that by far it was the most disturbing, and I read a review of it, of part of it, and so I kind of knew what was coming, and I found that I couldn't watch the whole thing. I'll confess, I could not watch all that. I read a description of everything that happened in it, but it seemed to me like it was just beginning to end about this cruel torturing of a black woman. It's got a lot of complexities, but what it comes down to, what you find out is that is happening, is that there's a black woman who is essentially being psychologically and physically tortured for sport day after day. For me, it's the real contrast to the national anthem. You know, whereas the white prime minister is shown to be kind of an innocent victim, the only leverage that people have on him to get him to do something is that there's a white child that has been taken and is being held hostage to get him to do it. Here, you know, you are made to see or made to feel that the black woman has been complicit in a horrible crime. I think people talk about this episode, they say there's some complexity because you do feel sympathy for her. But there's a world of difference between the fact that she was an accessory to a crime before all these things were done to her versus the prime minister who had not committed, you know, within the world of that episode, any crime that led to him being sent down that path. I'll also say, just talk about some real world context. There was a good review. I read a review of this on I think it's called AV Club was the website, and noted that it was based on what was called the Moores murders, which occurred in the 1960s, which were a series of rapes and murders of young children committed by a white man, Ian Brady, with Myra Hindley, a white woman, being an accessory to him and taping these crimes, these atrocities. There's a real difference, again, when this is translated into, you know, the Black Mirror world. The white woman in the actual crime is translated into a black woman in the series, and she is the one who is the recipient of, again, I think we both agree, the most disturbing sort of treatment that any character undergoes in what is a pretty disturbing series.
Without question, in my opinion, I think there's one that's kind of close only because it's similar, the episodes that happens, and it's involving a black person. So it's kind of the same thing in Men Against Fire later down the road. But yeah. I mean, for a lot of the reasons that you just laid out. In fact, it reminded me, unfortunately, of some of our earlier discussions. It reminded me a lot of Invisible Man, where you have someone, I don't have a name. I don't know where I am. Almost the scene after he gets the lobotomy or the electric shock after his accident in the paint plant. He doesn't know what's happening. And I just said that is such a theme for black people in the system of racism, white supremacy, where everything has been confiscated, where you're just totally confused about everything. And to have white people in this episode make this literally, they make an amusement park to torture one black person, this one black female. And it's dessert, like within the context of the story, it's dessert. She deserves all of this. Like this is that. And they're so meticulous. They show you the people going in and getting set up, and they have a calendar, and they just go in and mark off each day as they just go and do the same thing, and they bring in an audience. We talked about this last time with The Purge about a lot of the foundation of entertainment in America being about violence against black people, and that's what The Purge. Let's go watch a black person being hunted. With this one, it's we will go a black person who has no idea about anything. We've totally erased everything about them, and we'll just lie to them, and we'll just make an adventure out of it, and then we'll tell them the truth and totally humiliate them, and then we will torture them and yell at them and call them all kinds of nasty names and everything that we think, you know, they're all the scorn that we think they've earned. And then once it's all done, we'll erase their mind and do it all again tomorrow. Who could even fat? Like, on one level, I stopped and I said, wow, like, that is a whole nother level of pathology. Like, what kinds of twisted things could I do? Like, we could get people and just give them amnesia every day and just do this over and over and make up lies and do whatever we want to. The name, I said, they literally make an amusement park for all of this. And it's called the White Bear. I think it's the White Bear Justice Park. This is justice. You've killed, and it's a black female that's killed, a black child that has been killed by a white man. We couldn't punish the white man. I have a sound clip of that. I'm so upset because this is beyond me. My switchboard is failing. I had the sound clip of them when they were giving her the audio where they were explaining to her, like, this is what you did. This is why we're doing all of this. And this is you. And so they're reading the court transcript and all of that. And it's got within that segment where the judge rejected her claim. She said she was in a sexual relationship with a white man who killed this black child. And she said that this white man, she was under his spell. That was the word. She said, I was under his spell. And, you know, he just talked me into it. And it says the judge, the court rejected that and said that she was particularly wicked. And they describe her as an animal, a beast, a savage. She deserves all of this. And they are upset because her white boyfriend, he commits suicide in jail. And they say, oh, no, we lost out on him. We're not going to lose out on you. We're not going to lose our chance to torture and do whatever we want for as long as we want to you. It is amazing. And even more so with you sharing that information, because I didn't know that this was based on a true story where the authentic people that did these crimes were white. But in the story, we have to insert a black person to be the target of all of this almost unimaginable horror and torture. That, I mean, essence of the series right there. The more that you want to add, Dr. Kevorkian?
No, that's great. I will add just in a general sense that like The Purge, I think there's a lot of bad faith about this series. You know, The Purge, within the logic of the world of The Purge, they're always saying The Purge is terrible. We got to get rid of The Purge. But of course, they don't want The Purge to end because then you couldn't make another sequel. What you see again and again, one of the themes of Black Mirror is, oh, isn't it horrible how people revel in cruelty, how people are so ingenious in their cruelty? Isn't that terrible? And yet that's what all these stories are about, is reveling in and imagining cruelty. To me, it's hard to take at face value that that's just a critique of that kind of thinking. I would believe that it may be intended that way, but there is such cruelty that is devised here. And in this episode, it seems so selectively racially directed. When it is at its most cruel.
Do you make anything of, there's a white actor who's chasing her with a gun. She thinks it's and I mean, just imagine that you wake up, you don't know anything. You don't know your name, who you are, nothing. And the first thing that happens to you is you have a white man chasing you with a gun and people with their phones out just filming. They don't talk. You don't know anything. And you watch this episode from her perspective, right? You don't know what's going on in this episode until the very end. Like when the credits go up, that's when you get to figure out like, oh, okay, that's what I have watched for the last hour, when you can figure out everything. But for all of this to be happening, targeting specifically a non-white female, did you make anything of the white man with the gun who's chasing her? Did you make anything of the symbol? He has it's like a upside down H, and they say this is the tattoo that her white boyfriend had who killed the little black girl. Did you make anything of that symbol? To me, it almost kind of was hinting at a swastika somewhat. Am I making too much?
No, I mean, that's what I wanted to see. Is that like some kind of white supremacy tattoo, you know, that I don't know about? Or, you know, I mean, it tugs at that corner of your imagination, I think. I had that reaction. It's just like some kind of skinhead thing, or, you know, particularly knowing the episode's called White Bear, I'm thinking, you know, is this some sort of, you know, are these sort of, some sort of back, you know, particularly the idea of the guy with the gun in the woods, has a kind of a militia-like, perhaps white power group feel to it. I don't know.
Mm.
Yeah, I did see that tattoo and not know what to make of it, but have that feeling, and yet similarly didn't feel confident in saying, well, yeah, that's like a, you know, neo-Nazi thing.
Mm.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I heard a commentary on the radio that really, in the sort of normalization of kind of white supremacy talk that has happened in this Trump discourse, that a clever thing has happened. When analysts put it this way, that white supremacy got rebranded as alt-right. And I almost feel like there's almost an analogy between, you know, as white supremacy is to alt-right, the neo-Nazi swastika would be to that white bear tattoo, right? It's some sort of symbol of white supremacy, but that's been encoded or made less legible. That, you know, alt-right really is about white supremacy, but you notice that the word white has been eliminated from it. It's now aligned with the political ideology. It sort of denies its racist alignment in calling itself alt-right and tries to go mainstream. And that's exactly what has happened in this episode, is that a kind of white supremacy amusement park has become mainstream entertainment. I hadn't picked up, it was called the White Bear Justice Park, but it's also, you know, the White Justice Bear Park.
Excellent point. I also think it's notable, the reason it's called White Bear, the white black girl that's killed, that they're doing all. And I mean, that's so laughable to even try to submit, because they have her picture, right? The victim that was killed by this white man, that we're doing this in the name because we care so much about her, which is nonsense. Like, they're not doing anything for her family, anything. I do think it's relevant that the parents of this little girl that were killed, she has a black father and a white mother. We talk about that dynamic on the program. I would play the cowbell, but my switchboard is dead, which I'm really upset about, because I did invest time. I had great sound clips and I can't play any of them. So I'm a little peeved, but I think we still got it. What do you make? I guess I have to put it this way. I have been very critical of the whole campaign to get body cameras. I submit that the system of white supremacy for a long time gleefully looked forward to an opportunity for a photo shoot with a tortured, maimed, killed, raped, castrated black person. Gleefully looked forward to the opportunity to, you know, get a PR, let me, you know, get our pose and let's do all this. I don't think having body cameras is going to deter. I've stated for a long time, for years now, I think that this is just like modern lynching photographs. They're snuff flicks that whites do not have any remorse about anything bad happening to a black person, that they make jokes about this sort of thing. What do you make about this whole park is about the idea of spectacle. Come bring your phone and you can film a black person that we've totally confused, lied to. And we're here to have fun torturing and seeing them being mistreated. That's the same type of thing. Looking forward to spectacles, these events like these police shootings, where we can use our technology to capture black suffering and make some sort of a production, make some sort of a show out of it. What do you make of that comparison?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sickening in this episode, and it's sickening in the resonance it has with reality. I think there's, I don't know a lot about what is going on with the specifics of body cameras, but I did hear a professor describing the effect on sort of like on, you know, like a jury, of seeing something from the point of view of a body cam. And the mere fact that it is shot from the known perspective of a police officer already tends to bias the viewer against the person being viewed. So that is a kind of inherent bias, even in that, just in the point of view of the camera. We know it's an official camera. We know it's a camera of a law enforcer. So therefore what he or she is pointing the camera at, well, is possibly a wrongdoer, right? So that's already placed in the mind. This professor was discussing an incident in which a black man had tried to evade being pulled over, and it had ended in a death. And I think the point was made, what we don't see is the flip side. We don't see how terrifying and intrusive it was from that black man's perspective. We didn't get that point of view. We got the point of view of the official camera. But what's, you know, terrifying about the white bear scenario is that all of these people are given the authority of the law's perspective. All of their cameras now are being appropriated for that legally justified perspective. They can't see other than that the violence and the spectacle that is being staged for them is just. So I think it's kind of like multiplying the body camera effect by having them go through the orientation that they go through, by having them be on the premises of this thing that's called a justice park. You know, there's this idea that the camera captures the truth, but the camera captures a very particular point of view. And I think that is a real concern with body cameras, that it is always identified with putting justice on the side of the person who's shooting it.
Good point. That we talked about that connection to that word shot, camera, or gun. The person doing the firing generally has the power. And I think that's for sure is in this episode both ways. The people holding the gun were aimed. The people holding the guns and the cameras, they were all aimed at the black person, the black female being victimized in this particular episode. I guess to pick my one episode before I get in some of the callers, the whole black bear thing, I think they have a section at the very end. This is one of the few episodes where like the credits are going up and they're still like explaining, so you get the full debrief to make sure the audience is caught up to speed so they know what they just watched. So the credits are going up and they're telling the spectators, the people who come to the White Bear Justice Park, to torture this young black female who has no idea what's happening because she allegedly was an accomplice in this crime. They give them the rules and they say no talking and don't get too close. Like they're going out for some wild beast, like she is the bear almost. You know, stay away, don't talk, don't make any noise, blah, blah, blah. And then when they get to the end, they say, have fun. That's the most important thing. Have fun at this black person's expense. And even later on in the episode, she throws a brick at one of the people with the camera. She doesn't know. She thinks that they're just confused or whatever. She thinks they're just there to watch her. So she throws a brick. And one of the actors pulls out her taser, right? That should for sure be a code moment for black people. She pulls out her taser to threaten her, to make her stop so she doesn't harm any of the other spectators. And then they proceed from there. But just that moment also, I thought, was really making sure that the coding is there. Who is deserving of being tased with everything we've discussed over the past couple of years, police terrorism. Making my decision, I'm going to pick Be Right Back, Season 2, Episode 1. This episode, white woman, white man, starts off ostensibly as just a goofy romance with this couple. The white man gets in a car accident and dies. Nothing too crazy, no aliens, anything like that. The technology aspect comes in. They have software that can go through like your social media, your online postings and all of that. Your partner can give like personal emails and just more data, pictures, all of that stuff. And so they can reconstruct your voice, right? So you can be digitally reconstructed so this person can talk with software that will sound just like you, even after you're dead. So that's how it starts. She's talking to her deceased partner. And then it's advanced enough that they can provide a body. So now you have the whole person. He looks exactly, the robot or whatever looks exactly like her dead partner, sounds exactly like him, the whole nine. And so that's how the episode plays out. I watched this episode, I think, two or three times. And then I thought, oh, man. Is Ash, that's the white male who's died, is this robot, is this supposed to be code for a black person? Like your theory, these type of narratives where there's some non-human robotic entity that's, you know, kind of code for a non-white person. Is robot Ash, is that code for a non-white person?
Wow. I mean, I'm ashamed to say that I missed that. And because I just thought, oh, yeah, this is, kind of a sentimental episode about white people. But you're absolutely correct, and we've discussed this before, that even the origin of the term robot means slave or forced labor, and basically one of the other ways is he ends up basically being incarcerated by the end of the episode. He's kept up in the attic and not let out, and only gets to talk to people occasionally. He becomes an exploited and imprisoned body, could very well, for all those reasons, be read as a robot that is an encoding of the enslaved black body. I thought about the virtualization of people. Maybe that there's a parallel there between this Ash character, who is constructed for this woman, Haley, Martha Haley Atwell is the actress. And so he is there to sort of, as a fantasy creation just for her needs. And I wonder if there's an analogy then between him and the fantasy, virtual black man in Nosedive, that might be another layer of the plantation vibe of the Bryce Dallas Howard episode, that when she goes to this ideal living community, the place where she wants to get into, one of the things that appeals to her, is they show her a billboard where it's her and this handsome black man, and he's not, made into a character. He's not human. He's just a virtual presence as far as this episode is concerned. But I wonder if, just as you say, if the Ash character, the robot in Be Right Back, is like the black body, if the Nosedive episode is a further hint at the way those two fantasies overlap.
Wow. I'd say that's a good point, because I think in the Nosedive episode, which we discussed earlier, where she goes to see the house, and you're right, they have the image up where they have her fantasy depiction where she's living in the exact house that she wants, and she has her fantasy mate who happens to be a black male, and the realtor asks, are you interested? And she says, very interested. I thought that was underlined. That would definitely be another cowbell, tongue-in-cheek for sure. And then within this episode, I thought with Ash, it could be racial coding. This is season two, so this came out in 2014. Oh. I thought it could be racial coding because the only thing the robot Ash is good at, other than like the mimicking of social media type things, is sex. I think that's like the only improvement where she says he's really, I think they even make a point. They show before Ash dies, they show them having sex because she gets pregnant. They show them having sex. He's bad at it. He has to apologize. The robot comes and he's really good. And she makes a point of saying, oh my gosh, you know, great. Where did you learn all this? And they go from there. But after that, he's terrible. He's not good at anything. And it at least for me, I think James Baldwin talked about this notion of if you are a black male, you just are thought of almost as this walking dildo. That's the way that you are perceived. Maybe you're good for some sexual gratification. And that's about it. And as you state, that's about what happens to him. She almost gets him to commit suicide. She can't do it. So then they just stuff him in the attic and leave him there.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about the James Baldwin angle there, but I think that versions of that are present in maybe some of these other episodes as well. I would say that the kind of the Earl Butts context is there. Something that you educated me on last time that I completely missed in The Purge, where I sort of was right. If to quote, you know, Donald Trump, you played a clip that to me just sounded like, oh, well, that's just locker room talk. And you said, no, that specifically has a racial history of black man being dismissed and only being serious about sex. Just as the Ash character, as you say, even Ash suggests something dark, right? Like something burned and dark. Is good at sex. You see other characters in this series who are black men and who are to some degree shown as being controlled by sexual drives. It happens in Men Against Fire, where the black man is given this fantasy character called Dream Girl or Dream Woman. She's not a real character, but again, the white man says, oh, you'll have real good dreams tonight, something like that. Also in probably the most celebrated episode of the whole series, The 15 Million Merits, there's the black man who basically gives up all of his labor and all of his dreams and all of his merits that he has earned by riding on this treadmill all this time to fulfill the dream of this white woman who he hears singing, and who it also shows that he has, whenever she's around, it implies that he's having a sexual response to her presence.
That kind of left some on the table. The episode he just mentioned, 15 Million Merits, that's episode two, right? And even that, when I was talking about the sexual deviance, you start with a white male raping a pig. And then you give us our Othello. The black male has run mad with this white woman that he can't have. And even they double up on it because not only does he not get her, he doesn't get her, but then she just ends up becoming like one of their prostitutes where he's forced to watch another black male get to have sex with her. So they double up in the next one. And I mean, that, I think Mr. Kanye West has a lyric in his song where he talks about the way that racists pathologize sexual intercourse with about black people, that sexual intercourse with a black person is thought about on par with having sex with an animal or some sort of other deviant act. One of his lyrics, Hell of a Life, from 2010. But you start first episode, man having sex with pig. Second episode, black male frustrated and denied access to sexual access to a white woman.
Yeah, he does get a paper penguin out of it.
Right. Right. And orange juice and a nice cushy view. I guess, you know, gets some improvement in life. We will nab our callers. I'm so upset about the switchboard because I had audio clips for some of the portions that we talked about already that I wanted to just kind of solidify, but just try and compensate as we go. That is a real bummer, though, that my switchboard went out on this day. The number is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you do not grasp why invest time discussing this show, this series, I'm sure there are a lot of people who haven't seen it. You can articulate that. Again, I would submit a lot of the same themes that we talked about in The Purge. They're present in this film series. I think this film series is going to become very popular. There are some other very important episodes that we haven't even discussed, but I think a lot of just the core things that we talk about on this broadcast all the time are expressed, articulated in Racism, White Supremacy. Hopefully that's come out in the discussion already. I guess quickly, since you did bring that episode up, Black Milk Bing is his name, where he gives $15 million to get this white woman on the show and loses out on her. The Othello episode, I call it. What do you make of Wraith Babes for this episode? Everyone has to bike, right? Like, you have to power. That's how they get electricity or current or whatever it is. So you have to go and bike a certain number of hours, and you get credit to, so you can buy things, toothpaste, food, whatever. Whatever you need. They have commercials that air on television during the day. One of the commercial programs is Wraith Babes. And it's like this pornographic show, basically, that you can watch that while you're biking or while you're in your room or what have you. What do you make of this show? They keep showing it over and over. It seems to be an important aspect of that episode.
Yeah, it is. It's later identified with one of the judges, who is called Judge Wraith. And he's the one who leads the charge to have this woman who's the singer become a Wraith Babe. And he is portrayed by a black man. So there are judges up there in this kind of American Idol type scenario. But it's the black judge that, when he sees the woman, speaks first and makes a sexual or vulgar suggestion, rather than wanting to have her sing. So he is identified with that kind of crass superficiality and sexualized discourse of the social media. The audience, you know, feeds on it and they back him up on it. But I think it's important that he's the one that is shown first having that that kind of desire. But the Wraith Babes, the other thing I want to say about the Wraith Babes is, the ad's always saying, like, sort of like the dirtiest women in the dirtiest situations or something like that. But, you know, when the main Jessica, what's the actress who is the main woman, Abby is the character's name. When she becomes a Wraith Babe, we pretty much only see shots of her face. So we understand that there's a kind of degradation that is going on. But she herself, like as an actress, is not shown in an exploitative way. And I found that to be another one of the asymmetries or sort of injustices of the show is the contrast that to the virtual character that I mentioned, who I think is comparable to the Wraith Babes, the Dream Girl from the Men Against Fire episode, who is shown very explicitly in a very exploitative way and in a very dehumanizing way. There's one scene in which you're shown multiple images of her simultaneously, which is something that, you know, suggests something that's not human. The Wraith Babes are part of the pathology of the society, but to me it was interesting the way that Black Mirror, in terms of what they actually showed of Wraith Babe versus what they showed of Dream Girl, that there was a difference between the very exploitative display of the black woman in the black man's fantasy versus the Wraith Babes as they are actually shown in the show. But I welcome, obviously, were you reading something into the word wraith or?
Well, I thought that was important too. The word wraith, and for folks out there, wraith is W-R-A-I-T-H, wraith. And then some of the definitions, a ghost or ghost-like image of someone, especially one seen shortly before or after their death. Okay, next one. Used in similes and metaphors to describe a pale, thin, or insubstantial person or thing. And then the next one, a wisp or faint trace of something. A sea breeze was sending a gray wraith of smoke up the slopes. So those are the three definitions, which now the definition I do think is very important with all of this as well, particularly since this is, I think it's all white women that are the wraith babes in this. And I think the fact that they are ghost-like or seen shortly before or after death, that would be a way of describing a white woman, because I think all of the wraith babes, I think their partners are all black males in this film. As you stated, the judge, who seems like he's the one in charge of this show, is a black male. He starts off in that vein. Again, it go back to that James Baldwin quote. That's how we think of black males, sexual deviance, walking phallic symbol. That's the way that we think about them, and sexual intercourse with them should be thought about that as well. Like the most, you know, deviant, worst possible act, akin to death, a white woman having sexual intercourse with a black male. That was kind of my reading. But I also thought that that was a extremely important point that you made, juxtaposing the white woman, Abby, in this episode. You don't see her nude. You don't see her, you know, you're basically just seeing her face, her pale. I would say she's very pale too. I think that's significant. You're just seeing her face with a black male's finger in her mouth. And they just let your imagination do the rest. But with the black female later on, it's total nude. You get to see her breast. And I think that might be the only time that they have like female nudity in the series. I would have to think and double check, but even the other sex scenes that are in, you don't see nudity when he rapes the pig. You don't see nudity when the robot is having sex with the white woman. The episode that we just discussed, I don't think that's there for any of the other episodes. But this black female, she's totally nude, totally sexually explicit. And the cloning of her, I thought, was that just further added, exactly as you said, of course, this is not a human. This is, we clone sheep. We clone animals or something clearly not human. So that just, again, amplifying the sexual deviance. Black, I think that, to me at least, that seems to come through clear consistently throughout the series, sexual deviance in black people. I will pause there. Did that answer your question? That was what I was thinking about, Wraith Babe. Did that answer your question?
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Folks who dialed in, we'll just go right down the line. 1842, I think she saw some of the episodes in the series. 1842, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yes, I did. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. Greetings, everybody. Thank you for coming on the line. For the episode, I'm forgetting the title right now. It's escaping me. But where... I'm sorry, give me one second. Not White Bear. I'm mixing them up. Nosedive. Yes, thank you. For Nosedive. Okay. One of the things, y'all had great commentary. One of the things I've been kind of noticing, though, is with this, like, this particular white woman, she's not, quote unquote, Nene, her best friend, you know, skinny and blonde and all that. She's like the rejected white female by, it seems, a lot of white people. And so when I see her getting points on social media, she's like actively being like really nice to the non-white black people that she comes in contact with, you know, with the cookie and like all of that at the cafe. They're also the ones that like ding her later. But then she goes through the whole process where she just keeps losing points, keeps losing points. She shows up at the reception to give her speech. And, you know, she cusses everybody out. She, you know, and then she gets locked up. And at the end, she removes her top and she's in a cell across from the cell of a, well-dressed, dark-skinned black male. And, you know, they kind of go at each other for a second. Well, what are you looking at? I was wondering the same thing. And then they just begin to, degrade each other until it just kind of climaxes into this F you, like back and forth for like a couple of seconds. And for me, when I kind of thought about it, and I would like to get your thoughts on it, is, you know, you have, she's not ugly, but she's not the, you know, most beautiful white woman. And I've seen this trend before of like these white women who get with these black males. They're usually a lot of times rejected already by, you know, their white counterparts. And then they find acceptance with black people. Black people accept them. They're like, oh, this white person is so cool. They're nice to me. They're kind to me, whatever. They want to have sex with me. And then they get with a black male and then they, you know, do whatever. Do you see that at all in this episode? Because then she seemed vindicated. Like, she was like, yes, now I'm alive. And here's this black male. And of course, they aren't actually copulating or having sex, but it's very, it's like a sexual scene to me, especially with the F you. And they just seem to excite each other. Did you see that? Or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there is a kind of a virtual, like almost sexual climax, you know, or catharsis in that end of, in the, that rapid cutting, like their, even their faces kind of start to merge, you know, as if, you know, that this, it's almost predicting, you know, that they will have a union. And, you know, it's like one of those average faces of the future, like, you know, that it's somewhere between the two colors. So it does seem to project their union. I think you're absolutely right to notice that she's very carefully portrayed from the very beginning as not the idealized white woman, not the perfect Nene, right? And, like, you know, she's shot in a kind of unflattering way in like a kind of unflattering sweats as she's out running. Like, you can see like she's trying to, you know, change her body type, but maybe she's not that ideal body type. She's working on it. I do see the trajectory that you outlined. And even when she goes to that kind of that coach, doesn't she get some sort of special like life coach who's an expert in getting people to raise their ratings?
Mm-hmm.
And he initially, right? Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes.
And I think he says something along the lines of, well, like, you know, yeah, you get some reciprocal fives from people in the service industry. But you're really wasting your time with those people. So, you know, the official word of real success in this society is don't waste your time being nice to those people. And then she goes, as you say, to the wedding, which is the world of Nene, the world of the idealized white people and that, you know, the perfect, you know, Ken doll. And is it true? I think at the wedding, I think every person is white. Is that true or my?
It does appear that way. When she has the microphone behind her, there seems to be a woman who might be like from India or something like that. But there aren't any clearly black people. I didn't see any. I could be incorrect, but I didn't see any.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that supports the idea that, you know, she starts out trying to make her way by being nice to these people at the, so to speak, at the bottom of this hierarchy. She gets a white expert who tells her that's not the way it's going to work for you. But then she experiences ultimate rejection at this highest level of, you know, white perfection. And then, so to speak, she's bumped back down to having to settle for someone who is not from that layer. Although it's also interesting, as you say, that it's coded that he's a well-dressed black man. He's got like a tuxedo on. Like, maybe he just got kicked out of a wedding too for giving the same speech, but was, you know, someone who has money and style and he's not portrayed as, you know, of a like, obviously criminal element. He's not coded in those ways. But yeah, thinking about it from, you know, the show, the story is from her perspective. So you're meant to feel that she is liberated, that she can be genuine with this man. But it is instructive to do what I think you've done is turn around and flip it. What is this like from the black man's perspective? Is he, you know, what rule is there that he is supposed to embrace this woman who's been rejected by the white perfection squad? Does that follow along with what you're saying, or I'm not sure if I've done. I'm not sure I've done
justice. I appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've done justice to your work, but I'm just trying to think through, and I think it does play out in that sort of she's down and she's up, and then it implies that she has to come back down to find a love connection. So.
Do you have another question, or you said?
I'm okay for now. If there's time later, I'll try to get one in. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
You didn't want to ask, I guess earlier in the broadcast, Dr. Kevorkian.
Actually, I did.
Okay.
Okay.
I didn't want to take up. Okay, earlier you were speaking, and I'm not exactly sure about which clip it was, but you said maybe you're acting white there. Do you recall when you said that?
When I said maybe, maybe what? Acting what?
Acting white.
I think I was talking about in The Purge when the white purgers are coming to Ethan Hawke's door and they say, we want to act fairly with you. We want to be fair with you. And I said, if you think about that word from the perspective that Mr. Renegade is teaching us to think about, that fair is about white, saying we want to be fair with you is saying kind of like we want to be mighty white with you. It's equating white behavior with just behavior, with fair behavior.
What I heard is you said I could just be acting white, and I wanted to ask you what you meant by that, and if you could just, what does it mean when someone says I could just be being white or I'm just acting white? What's that mean?
I don't recall having said that, but if I did, I would mean my own limited perspective from. In a sense, it's a version of what I just said, that the episode itself, Nosedive, I think, is acting white. And my tendency is to, even though I'm being critical of it, to still talk about it from Bryce Dallas Howard's perspective. So I suppose one element of acting white would be being a white person and identifying with the white characters and their perspective, and not... not taking not making the effort to think, well, what does it look like from that black character's perspective who comes in at the end, or from other black characters? Do you associate particular behaviors with acting white or being white? And you don't have to answer that. I just wondered if you wanted to give us a definition that you had in mind. If you don't, it's not my place to ask you for it.
I actually don't have it, but I do appreciate you answering the question. I just had a quick follow-up, though. If that means if someone could be acting white, it's just because I was listening, and I was like, whoa, that's really interesting. I'd love to know what that means. And so if you're not looking at it from the black characters, or the black person's perspective, when we're analyzing Black Mirror and The Purge and things like that, where mass violence and brutalization of black bodies, black people is, occurring either just like outrageously or kind of subversively. But if someone is to act white, does that mean like you would sympathize with the white person despite the negativity you're seeing against black people? Like would that, and that would just be acting white? And that'll be my final question. I'll mute myself.
It sounded like Gus wanted to make a comment. I'm sorry. No?
I think she just said she was muting her live. That was going to be her final question.
Okay. Yes. I think that is one of the limitations of acting like a white person that white people need to confront is failure to do other than identify with the white characters when they're analyzing the story or analyzing the world. So I think that's a good challenge.
Right on. My switchboard is working again. Right on. Wonders never cease. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? Line should be open. Thomas in New York.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Dr. Kevorkian. I had three questions really. Hopefully I can get them in. Based off of what you guys were talking about earlier, I've never seen it. So, as a white man, do you think, Dr. Kevorkian, that black people are viewed by white people as technology that they've created that have gone wrong?
I think that Black Mirror does make that connection. Yes.
I'm talking about in general, and the average everyday white person, when they look at a black person, are they looking at them as a type of technology that's going wrong, a technology that can replace them?
Yes. Writing that down. Looking at black people as a technology that's gone wrong. I think that is an attitude that is out there. Obviously, I'm not going to say that all white people think that in some sort of generalization, but I think that's definitely one kind of fear. That's one way a fear of black people is expressed. And it is interesting to think of that. It's a technology that's been created that has gone wrong. So even in that sense, there would be some kind of acknowledgement of white guilt. In other words, the history of slavery. Slavery is the process, the original process by which people are turned into things. People are turned into technology. It's a kind of a sad fact about people, but often they behave the most angrily when they are in the wrong and they even know that they're in the wrong. So I think that it's quite common in America when white people see black people that they see an element of guilt and the legacy of slavery, and that they, in your words, that legacy of slavery can be thought of as a technology that has gone wrong.
Thanks for that answer. Were you going to say something, Gus?
No, sir.
Oh, okay. When you were here in August, you said that Trump's message resonated with white males who feel disenfranchised. Why do you think that his message ended up resonating with white females to the point where he got a higher percentage of the white woman vote than Hillary Clinton?
It's a very good question. Resonated. Well, the easy answer is that these were white females that are, part of families with these same white men, perhaps, who are similarly seeing themselves as having been cut out of a pie that they think is rightfully theirs. I think Hillary Clinton got herself into a lot of trouble. There was a lot of resentment that was generated by her comment about deplorables. And I think there were a lot of angry white men and women who sort of lashed against her for that remark. And specifically, when she made that remark, she was lumping that with, she mentioned racists as being in the bag of deplorables. So I think they were angered by that. The thing again that I kept hearing though was what white females who were interviewed on camera would say, that they admired Donald Trump for speaking his mind. And again, I think that plays into the nosedive logic. That they're white men, yes, also, but white women too, were out there who wanted to be liberated from what they perceived as the PC police, as Gusty Renegade called it.
My last question for you, and it's on topic but off topic. There's a particular television show that I've caught a few times. I find it to be extremely racist, and I just wanted to know if you've seen it and what was your assessment of it. It comes on Showtime, and it's called Shameless. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
It's on Showtime. Sorry, it's called what?
Shameless.
Oh, Shameless. Shameless. No, I have not seen Shameless. I've seen like the image for it, and it looks like a bunch of kind of angry white people. So I think maybe that plays into what we're thinking about. I guess it's like a kind of a hard drinking, down and out white family. I wouldn't want to speculate too much. I mean, you have perceived the racism in this show, Thomas. But yeah, I think that, to go back to the question from 1842, part of acting white, in this context might be being gratified by watching a show about angry, disenfranchised, white people who are in some way acting out or striking back or acting in ways that are not deemed politically correct. Again, not if you've seen it, but even the word shameless kind of suggests that. Wanting to be shameless, wanting to say what's on your mind, wanting not to be filtered, wanting not to be policed, wanting just to be able to express your white anger in a shameless way. This is completely lateral, but and I won't go into it, but there are the only two shows that I haven't seen a lot of shows recently, but I saw a few episodes of Wayward Pines, and I saw a few episodes of The Americans, and I thought these were both had examples of white families, specifically white couples, being aligned against a black man. That was evident from just the first few episodes. I don't know if there are black characters in Shameless or if it's just the sort of the white acting out itself. Mr. Renegade, have you seen Shameless?
I have not. People have mentioned Americans to me before, but I haven't seen that either. I really make an effort to try to shirk some of the television programs because they can just consume a lot of your time and all that. I tried to shirk Black Mirror, but I watched Nosedive, and there here we are. But yeah, I have not seen haven't seen Shameless.
So I just want to say my other shows. Those were not recommendations to anyone to go watch those. I'm just saying I watched a few episodes and I thought, yep, they're doing it again. So yeah,
they always do it. They always do it. Had that as I can play that one still. I have my sound clip for that one. I can get in. Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. The caller at 0325. Did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yes. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Kevorkian. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening. Good evening.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about the episode, The Waldo Effect. And I want to also ask a question about Purge, but The Waldo Effect, I noticed that a lot of people talk about it being, an allusion to Trump. That's definitely there. But I want to touch on or get Dr. Kevorkian, get your a view on the fact that Waldo is blue. Of course, blue being, when animated characters are blue, that means they're, really black. And at the end, at the very end of it, they show Waldo on a big screen, and it has Hope, Change, and Believe, and the guy, the comedian that was playing Waldo, he's like Blum on the street, And to me, that kind of signifies that essentially that, you know, I guess that the Trump phase was over. And I mean, I don't know if it was making allusion to Barack Obama, but it seemed to like make an allusion to Barack Obama, especially when the black American came in and talked to them about globalizing Waldo. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that. And then my second question was about the purge and the technology as far as the drone and the technology that the white supremacists used to find the white lady and the black people actually being in the movie, being the technology that Leo used and that they used. So one side used technology and the other side used the black people as technology to find each other. And so those are my two questions.
Great. Yeah. The Waldo effect, I hadn't stopped to think about the Waldo being blue and that it's sort of like, you know, like when they do like Olympic emblems of different athletes, like I can't remember what Olympic was, they came up with blue, like to try to avoid the race question, but then it becomes, even by trying to avoid it, by trying to say this is not racialized, it makes it about race. In light of, you know, one of the comments, you know, guest you made a few moments ago, you know, the James Baldwin effect that black men are sort of identified as a walking phallus. Well, that's definitely how that's what Waldo is. He's it's like unfettered id and is often almost all of his jokes are kind of like phallic jokes and things of that nature. So as a virtual, another sort of virtual body, you could line, you know, in light of your comment at 0325, you could then line up Waldo with Mr. Gusty Renegade's remarks about the character Ash in See You Soon, the robot. It's sort of the Waldo then is sort of a, you know, a cartoon of like almost like a sex toy, so to speak, a sex technology. I didn't pick up the thing about the hope and change, but I definitely did notice what you were saying, that the American who wants to exploit Waldo, who comes from the agency, is a black man, Agent Jeff Carter. And I did find that to be another theme in this Black Mirror series that I don't think I've mentioned before, that there's another kind of set of black characters who are always the ones who are most cynically on board with this new technological regime. I think of the American operative in Waldo being that. It's very cynical how he wants to manipulate people using that. And whereas we see like the white character has some sort of moral or ethical qualms, and he's sort of punished for that weakness, that's why he's on the outs at the end, that he doesn't sort of get on board with the Trump bandwagon. Ultimately, he's finally sick and biting, opts out, but we think of him, you know, we again have sympathy for him. All these episodes try to make us have sympathy for these white characters and the choices they make. But we don't have sympathy for this black person who has no qualms at all about exploiting Waldo for all he's worth. Another really minor character along those lines is the episode 1.3 is called The Entire History of You. There's a young lawyer who works for a law firm, and he's being interviewed by some executives, one of whom appears to be a black man. And they're saying, we want you to head up this new kind of lawsuit that we're going to have where kids can retroactively sue their parents by replaying these memories and showing that they didn't get enough attention. And the white character who's being interviewed says, are we okay with that ethically and morally, like inventing this whole new kind of lawsuit for kids to persecute your parents? And really quickly, the black man who's the executive in the room says, yep, just really quick. So I saw the black American operative in the Waldo moment as being aligned with those set of black characters in these narratives that, are fully on board with whatever this new social media technological regime is. So let's see, the second comment was about the purge and the drone that is used to seek out and find people, and that being equated with Black people being used as a technology. And yeah, I think that I can associate drones with, that's kind of a weak connection. I was going to say that drones are often associated with what is called Black Ops, but I don't think I have a really strong point to make about beyond what you suggested there about that. But I do agree that is another situation in which blackness, Black bodies are being equated with technology. So thank you.
Appreciate that, caller. The person who dialed in, we had some people that wrote in questions too. The person that dialed in, 4789. 4789, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Can I have a hand?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
I had two questions, but like a quick comment is that former Prime Minister David Cameron, he was accused of having sex with a dead pig by Lord Ashcroft, who is also an elite. And so he, so that came out, I think, like last year, 2015, and that became a big scandal. So I thought, when I was watching this episode, I thought about that. I was like, maybe they knew something, the writers. My first question is concerning the Black Bear episode. Like, when I was watching it, I just thought it was like...
White Bear episode?
Sorry, Black Bear. Sorry, White Bear. Sorry, White Bear. Sorry. It kind of reminded me, like, of summer camp, especially at the end. And I was just wondering, like, my question is, what are some of the elements of, like, writing propaganda, Dr. Kubrick? Because, like, the people don't really care about the... Like, in reality, you know, the white people, they don't really care about the Black child. They don't they don't have any sympathy for this Black child. And then the way that it's written, the people are very angry at this Black person, but it's not like they're really angry at them. They just want to have sort of like fun with her. So I'm just wondering, like, what are some of the elements of writing propaganda? Because this was just propaganda to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that you're right, and also as Gus has said, that it's not about sympathy with the Black child, but the Black child is being manipulated as yet another, just another image and another a justification. In terms of propaganda and kind of indoctrination that takes place, one of the key things to move people to do horrible things in propaganda is to view the target or the enemy as somehow less than human. I think that's done very, very deliberately in the way that the people in the White Bear episode are introduced to the camp, that they're being made to think of the victim that will be the source of their entertainment as so far outside of human norms, being so deviant or being aligned with someone who is so deviant that she can be treated as though she were not human. I will also say that some of the cruelest element is, one of the cruelest elements also does, of course, then depend on the fact that she is human, because one of the cruelest things is that she's made to think that the girl in the picture is her own daughter, and then she's told that this was the girl that was killed. So even when it dehumanizes her, it still uses, we might say, a human maternal impulse for yet another dose of cruelty. I don't know if I can speak to other elements of propaganda, how they are operating, but I think any sort of strategy that reduces, takes humans and reduces them to mere images or symbols. It can be very effective.
Okay. Thanks. My last question is, how powerful are like names, I guess, in like flight culture? Because I just noticed like unlike other guests, especially like Black guests, they don't remember people's like names or like people's like the last four digits. Like, I recognize that you remembered like 1842 and like you were saying Gusty Renegade and I think you said 033, but I'm not sure. But and I've noticed that like about like white people, they're like very conscious and like very deliberately like call out names. Like, I was just wondering, like, from an English perspective, how important our names were from like your just your knowledge.
But I really appreciate that you're asking that question. I think names are extremely powerful. I'll just confess that I say Gusty Renegade all the time just because I love to say it and it's awesome. But it's a great name. it helps me. I try to just keep straight, you know, where these ideas are coming from, and to try to give credit to voices and people, you know, who have had these ideas, and to have it be a conversation. But yeah, I think it's very, very powerful and very important to call people by the name that they wish to be called by. And I, you know, maybe don't always take as much care as I should. I'm sure no one really, really wants to be called, you know, 0325. I don't think that really warms anyone's heart, but if you have a name that you like, I think you deserve to be called by it. You know, there are philosophers that talk about this, but you know, that you want to have a human. It's the opposite, I guess, of propaganda. It's to recognize someone as being a human, and that's why I think just even on average, looking at these episodes, you know, there's a difference between, and I don't always remember the character's name, but definitely the Bryce Dallas Howard character's Nosedive has a name, right? And other characters have a name, but a lot of the Black characters don't have names. They have names like Stewardess or Man in Jail or was the Man on Moped Man. And if you think about, there's the episode, the Shut Up and Dance, only the white characters that are the victims of this social media scheme get names and get the full sympathy. So there's the white kid and the white man, and they form a kind of a bond and a team, and they're fully humanized. And then there's this other guy that's also a victim, and he's just Moped Man. He doesn't have a name. So I think it's important to notice how on average stories distribute names, who gets to have names, who doesn't get to have names. So, I'm sorry, should I ask you, do you have a name? I also understand that people on these shows sometimes like to have their anonymity. So,
is that why, like, in real life, like, we see it in like sports or something, like, why Black people are always given a nickname? Like, I don't know, it would be like Cadillac Williams or something, like they're always given a nickname.
That is true.
Does that take their humanity away in a sense?
I think it depends on the nature of the nickname. I guess I have to be maybe more critical, because I was just thinking that you know, that we don't have any, that the nicknames are not as good as they used to be. I used to think of Hakeem the Dream Olajuwon, and I don't think there's something dehumanizing in calling him the Dream, or Clyde the Glide Drexler. Because I guess in both of those cases, it incorporates the man's full name, and then adds an element to it that is an element of praise that doesn't, I would think, dehumanize him necessarily. But I can think of other, you know, there might be other nicknames that are more reductive. Certainly anytime, you know, like, as you said, like if someone's nickname is, you know, hog or, you know, bear or, you know, things like that. Then there is a definite gesture that could go towards dehumanizing in that kind of a nickname. I could be wrong about all that.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
For sure. For sure. The person, I did want to get in that episode. We didn't talk about that episode, but season 3, episode 3, Shut Up and Dance, where some faceless entity is blackmailing people. They have captured, they've got all this incriminating evidence, and so they're making people go do all of these zany tasks, in some cases criminal activity, in order to not release the evidence. One of the incidents of blackmail is a white woman where she has passed racist emails about black people being dumb and stupid. And so she has to do these tasks or they're going to leak the emails, which they do anyway. They leak the emails and that comes out at the end. But that's goes back to the point I was making earlier about this notion of whites being under attack, their racist pathologies being exposed with this new technology. That theme happens. And that episode is only it's 2 episodes away. So season 1, episode 1 is Nosedive with the Bryce Dallas Howard episode. And then 2 episodes later, it happens again, the same theme, a white woman being taken down for practicing racism via social media. The person that dialed in 4683, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
You are not the clearest. I guess if you could make sure if you're maybe get a little closer to your microphone.
Okay. How about now? Can y'all hear me now?
That's an improvement.
Okay. All right. How you doing, Dr. Kevorkian? Hey, I got two quick questions, man. Would you happen to be in a relation to Dr. Kevorkian, the old, what do you call it, abortion doctor?
The assisted suicide man. As far as I know, I'm not. I mean, we all come from the same pretty small little plot of land back in Armenia where my father was born. And I've got kind of a long, scary face like Dr. Kevorkian. And I confess, I do try to go with that for all it's worth. But my father, when he was alive, was actually mistaken for Dr. Kevorkian. But as far as I know, I am of no relation to him.
Okay. And then my other question, you know, with all the different things that, you know, so-called white people have said, you know, about black people, like, you know, just different things, we lazy, we, you know, we savages and all this. I wanted to ask your opinion of what you think that all these films and movies and TV shows, what does that say to you about the pathology of whites?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if it do say anything to you, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned particularly a couple of the things that you mentioned were that the things that white people accuse black people of being lazy or being savages. And I think both of those are revelatory of human pathologies and of pathologies that white people are projecting, but are flaws that they themselves have. You know, I've maybe said it before, but I think that, you know, laziness is one of the origins of racism. It's not wanting to do the work and wanting to force someone else to do the work for you. So, you know, every accusation, you know, if you're talking about, you know, the history of slavery and calling the slaves lazy, that's just very baldly a projection of white people's laziness onto the people that they're trying to get to do the work for them. So, I just think it's very common that when people, this doesn't necessarily even have to be a racial thing, but anytime you talk about someone you don't like, you say, I don't like this about him or I don't like this about her, very often those will be traits or weaknesses that you yourself have. So, yeah, I think that so many of those stereotypes are just pretty simple boomerangs that, you know, that, you know, savages is not a term that, you know, should be used for example, I was talking about the lazy example of it, savagery, but cruelty is certainly an appropriate term. And I think the pathology of cruelty is very much on display in Black Mirror throughout it.
Appreciate that, caller. The person at 4950, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, it's kind of movie related, but it's not on the topic of the same show. Is that okay?
I don't know if I don't really want to have a free fall of everyone just calling in with random shows, random unrelated shows. Which show is it
okay if I just? I'm sorry, Gus. Is it okay if I just reserve that question for you at the end of the program, then?
All right.
That'll be fine. Thank you, sir.
Oh, okay. Lashy, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? Oh, she wanted a book, by the way. Lashy's emailed. She wanted to put in her reservation. She wants would like a book, please.
Thank you. Thank you for asking for that. Yeah, so I'll make sure to get that information where to send it.
Got it.
Lashes.
Yeah. Are you there, Lashes? Did you want to get your question? Not hearing you. I don't know if you hit your mute button. Should be with us. Let's see. Still not hearing. I don't know if she's just listening. We're not hearing you. I don't know if you hit your mute button or if you're having some audio issues. If you're just listening, or maybe she can't talk right now. I will check again and see if we hear from you. The person who called at 2812, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yes, good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Dr. Kevorkian. Couple of quick questions. Specifically, in the episode for White Bear, the main thing that stood out to me was there was a scene to where the black female was just standing in the middle of the street. And she was just looking around her, and she just kept saying, "Why aren't they helping me?"
Mm-hmm.
And she kept saying that, like, repeatedly, like, "Why aren't they helping me?" And I just recall all the different images that we've seen over the couple of years, like Gus had alluded to earlier, in reference to just black people being slaughtered. And it's almost that same kind of feeling. Why isn't anybody helping me? It's almost like everyone is just a spectator to our torture. Would you agree that that's an accurate assessment?
I think that's a very strong condemnation. Yes, I think that's a useful thing to get from that. Why aren't they helping me? Why is the cloud of witnesses allowing this to happen? That line did strike me too. Why aren't they helping me? I mean, it's that kind of complaint, it comes off in different ways. I mean, in that scene, I felt genuine sympathy for that complaint, why aren't they helping me? Which is a kind of a lament and a genuine cry. There's another version of it in the episode Nosedive, which is Bryce Dallas Howard is at the airport, and she just shouts, like, effing, help me, like it's a demand. So there's, on the one hand, there's the kind of help me that's the expectation that there's someone there to serve you. But I think there is a larger, more responsible, why aren't they helping me in the ethical sense that people have an obligation to one another when something, cruel is being done or when someone's being singled out that people need to come to their help.
Right. I just wanted to get in really quick
on that asking for help, because in Nosedive, there's a black male who's also requesting help where he the social media component, right? So if you get enough enough people hit you on social media, you can lose everything, like your job, your house, like it's that integrated. And so this black male has been the target of that. So he can no longer get into his job. And so he's asking for help. He's begging, literally, for help. He asks the main character, Bryce Dallas Howard's character, he asks for help. Can you give me a few stars, a few up ratings? And she totally ignores him. She's like, oh, I gotta go to work. Gotta leave. She just leaves him. He can't even get into the building. So the security comes and like back up, and he's just whining. And I think it's a very different request for assistance, where he's literally begging almost in tears. This black male in a green pastel suit can't access the building, where Bryce Dallas Howard's character, she has the same tone as her character from The Help. Like, nigger, help me right now. And it's the horror is she is not being helped. Like, this is The Help. And in fact, the black people turn on her and sabotage her social media account. But yeah, I thought that was interesting in terms of which perspective we catch, because she was not the only person to ask for help in that episode.
Yeah, I agree. My second question, Dr. Kevorkian, was, in all of these episodes, and I did actually plunge into them after Gus mentioned it last week over the weekend, there is a very strong, the mental torture is evident all over, particularly the one episode, and I don't have the name of it in front of me, to where the white male is injected with the small black device behind his neck, and he's literally being tortured by his own mind. Which was very, very interesting. And then all the other episodes where you had the therapist guiding the gentleman through dating, all this mental torture, and watching it, I couldn't help but think that I don't think that people who classify themselves as white are going to be doing this torture to themselves. And the reason why I mention that is because anything that the mind can, you know, conceive can actually happen. So the people thinking up these episodes and the people creating these shows obviously know that maybe this technology is on the way, but I suspect that this is not going to be used against people that look like them. Are these episodes kind of maybe symbols to show people to say, hey, you don't have to worry about it in the future, because this is specifically what we're going to be doing to non-white people? These are the different ways that we're going to torture them?
I guess, I mean, I did see very much the emphasis on mental torture, and I saw them as, I mean, it's interesting what you said, think about what would be realistic for what would happen in the future. I saw them as more exaggerated versions of the present, which are meant to kind of hype the idea of white powerlessness in this technological regime, to sort of make you feel sympathy. Oh, this poor white guy who's being tortured by his own fears, and also very much in White Christmas, where the guy is, you know, is left in, you know, to hear this White Christmas song over and over and over again for thousands of years. Is this idea that technology could be used to multiply punishment in such a way to kind of almost literalize hell? And a lot of these episodes seem obsessed with that. While watching them, I didn't see them as implicit threat that they're not going to do this to white people, but they are going to do it to non-white people. And it is also frightening what you say, that anything the mind can think of, you know, can conceive of it in, you know, it could happen. But I'd like to think not.
All right. And then Gus, can I get one more in?
Sure.
All right. I appreciate it. And then the last one was just in reference to, you know what, I totally forgot it. I had a brain freeze, but Gus, I'm good. Appreciate it.
Oh, okay. Might come back to you. Happens to the best of us. Let's see. I might be having one myself. Is this Praz? See if I get my names correct. Praz, is this you, or did I get my names incorrect?
Yes, this is. Greetings, everyone. I had a question for Dr. Kevorkian. The last caller was mentioning the episode Playtest. So I was thinking about, you know, in light of what Richard Spencer has been saying about, you know, he said that there are like too many Asians in Silicon Valley. So I was wondering if Playtest was sort of a cautionary tale dealing with the fear of whites letting too many non-whites dominate technology, particularly in video games or virtual reality scenarios.
Just for listeners really quick before Dr. Kevorkian responds, again, all these nutty episodes. So Playtest is season 3, episode 2. So this is the episode right after Nosedive. And the gist of it, it is a white male. He's traveling around the world. He needs money. He signs up to do this experiment that involves like a virtual reality type experience. All the people that are administering this test are non-white people. It's a black female, melanin-rich black female, and I think Asian male. They're in charge of all of this. So they give this white male, they inject like a drug in his neck, and they put this device on him, and he ends up kind of going crazy, shrinking it. But he ends up going crazy, and it goes from there. But it's another example of white powerlessness at the hands of technology and non-white people driving the technology. Now, do you want to go ahead and respond, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I do. I think that's a very good context about that sort of that is another element of the fear of technology is fear of Asian, super intelligence. That Asians somehow dominate the technological realm, and that is embodied in the, I believe it's a Japanese named Shu Sato, who is the genius, and he's labeled as a genius behind the horror game company. The other thing that I did see in that episode that in a way was kind of like Nosedive, is that there were two black women that were part of getting this white guy into this gaming scenario. There's the Sonya character early on who identifies this gamer opportunity for him, and sort of when the fantasy is going correctly, these black characters are enablers of what the white character sees as something desirable. Like he thinks it's going to be a great thing and he thinks he's going to have fun. Similarly, there's the black character who's called Just Katie, who hooks him up with the headgear and is kind of talk him through it. But in his own fears, both of these women sort of turn on him. That Katie doesn't help him and she says kind of mean things to him. And then Sonya shows up and she's trying to stab him and she says that I stole from you. This reveals kind of his underlying assumption that he didn't trust her and that maybe she was a criminal. So it's possible. One way to read this episode is actually to some extent, his racist fears of these two women are coming back to bite him.
Oh, my second question was, I noticed you mentioned that the series tends to try to make stories non-racialized. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking particularly of 15 Million Merits and Nosedive also, which feature like weight, there being sort of like a system of mistreatment based on weight rather than racial. And I just wonder why do they seem to equate like sort of like an overweight white woman is almost like at the same level as a non-white person? It's like a system of white supremacy rather than a system of white supremacy. Why is there that encouragement to sort of non-racialize it to weight?
I'm not sure, but I think that's a good observation. That's actually a good phrase. That white supremacy is being shifted in the representations onto weight supremacy, and I think that's something that is less considered to be less charged, less controversial. It's something that's less uncomfortable. Although that doesn't really make sense for this series because this seems to be a series that that likes to get uncomfortable, but I hadn't seen that. But that's right. The white supremacy is a cover for the white supremacy. It's interesting.
Yeah, like for example, 15 million merits. You know, if you're not able to ride the bike, then you wear yellow, and then you have to be sort of a janitor for all the bike riders. And then if you get even more overweight than that, then they put you on a show called Bother Guts, where then they humiliate you as part of one of the streaming services. And I was thinking about that and comparing it to like Jerry Springer, Maury Povich, you know, sort of the system where the lower down you are, then you, the only job you can have is to be like humiliated.
And killed. I thought that was important too, because in that 15 million merits, they have a game where you can shoot and kill, but you're shooting and killing the janitors. You might have to look a little close, but I mean, that's what you're doing. The people that go around and clean, the people that have got too fat to ride the bike, so they have to go around and clean. So then they have a game where you can then shoot and kill these people for points.
Yeah, and they're dehumanized because they're in these big yellow suits. So again, it's like the Waldo Bean all blue. It's like they're not white people, they're not black people. They're just big yellow targets. Right, and you see him playing that game.
Have you seen the series Westworld on HBO?
I have not.
I have not.
Okay. And there's a lot of these shows, Westworld, Humans. It's very similar to I'll Be Right Back. And it just seems like there's like a whole bunch of these shows. They're very popular. And it seems to be sort of a try to make a story non-racialized by using cyborgs or androids. So have you seen lately like there's a resurgence of this kind of media being promoted and being popular because it speaks to the fears?
Yeah, I know that was the case. I argue that that's the case in the original Westworld, which is based on Michael Crichton's script. That it's about the fantasy that robots will really be the servants of man, but that they will actually mount a kind of a slave rebellion. So I think that was present back in the, I guess, in the early 70s when that first came out. And I think you're probably right that there's a resurgence of that kind of anxiety. And I also think you're quite right to point it out, this kind of a deflection, just as, you know, I completely missed that in I'll Be Right Back that the Ash character could be thought of as a racialized robot. There's a lot of ways in which you can tell stories about cyborgs and have it appear not to be racialized. I'll even say also about 15 million merits. Another way that it seems like they really consciously don't want a negative racial script. Like they go out of their way to make the white character, the white men, the most disgusting characters. Like they're the ones that take the most sick pleasure in watching that Bother Guts show, right? There's that one particularly cruel black white guy who rides next to Bing and is always making remarks and watching Bother Guts or watching Wraith Girls. And it sort of goes out of its way to show some versions of even what you might call white mythology, as if to say, look, we're making all the white characters really bad. But nevertheless, unconsciously or not, there's a racial logic to the whole story.
Yeah. Is that messaging designed to sort of tell white people to be more refined in their practice of racism?
Huh.
We're supposed to look down upon the unrefined racist?
Yeah, I think that has been true. But I think that one of the things that sort of also is happening in Trump's America is that the unrefined racist is having his or her day too, right? That, that there was a period of in which there were certain things that simply could not be said in, you know, polite company, so to speak. And I think you're right that there are narratives out there. Again, this is, you know, I credit Prosby with that when pointing that out, I mean, it's not, that's not a thought that I had, that this is about asking white people to refine their practice. But I have seen that, that, you know, white people will tell other white people, oh yeah, don't say those racist things. And what they mean is really don't say them, but, you know, go ahead and think them. But, the bizarre thing that is happening now is that, there are some people who, white people who are also seeking the freedom to do it out in the open, right? To have the unrefined practice and have that be normalized.
Yeah. Hang tight, caller. I want to double check with Lashes, and we did have a caller who wrote in. The caller who mentioned this whole series to begin with, I didn't know anything about Black Mirror until our caller mentioned it, Jamie. She wrote about the San Junipero episode, which we have not discussed, which I did have in my notes. So San Junipero is season 3, which just came out last month. This was the first season that was on Netflix. So they released all 6 episodes of season 3 at the same time. I don't think they did that with the previous episodes. It was like normal television, you know, week at a time installment type deal. So season 3, episode 4, San Junipero, the stars, Gugu Mbatha-Raw. I hope I'm saying her name correctly. You all probably have seen her in something. She was in Belle. She was in Beyond the Lights with Nate Parker. She was opposite of Will Smith in Concussion. She was in Free State of Jones. So she is one of the main stars, Black female. Her white co-star, these two females are, wow, how to even explain. So they're in this like virtual reality, and you could go to these different clubs. You can go to different time periods. They use like clothing and music. They have a lot of codes so you know what time you're in. So sometimes they're in the 80s, sometimes they're in the 90s, sometimes they're in like the early 2000s. So you can go to all these periods of time. You have people who have died who are hanging out here virtually, even though they've died, they just get to hang out here forever. And you have other people who have like medical conditions or whatever. And so they get like a limited amount of time per week where they can hang out in this virtual reality and have sex. So you have this white female, Black female, they are in a virtual reality, like lesbian relationship type thing. And they go to all these different clubs and hang out. So it's kind of a romance thing. Just to kind of give the rough explanation of it. And they kind of have an argument at the end about whether or not once they both die, are they going to permanently stay in this virtual reality after they are deceased? So our listener, she wrote in about this episode specifically. She wanted to get your thoughts, Dr. Kevorkian. She said she was struck by this episode for a number of reasons, but mainly the portrayal of the Black female who taught this white woman to broaden her sexuality and accept her sexuality and love for women. The Black female is the experienced lover teacher, where the white woman is meek and inexperienced. The Black female goes so far as to decide she has found true love with this innocent white woman, despite being married for 49 years. And they make it a part of the plot that the white woman, in actuality, she is like paralyzed. She's bedridden. She had a nasty car accident after she came out as being gay to her parents. They didn't accept. And so she's had, you know, a very restricted existence. So this virtual reality has been a real, you know, experience for her to be able to broaden her existence. What were your thoughts about the San Junipero episode, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I thought there was, this is one of the episodes I had in mind when I said that there's a real asymmetry or sort of injustice in the treatment of the white and the Black characters. This is one of the episodes that gets talked about the most as being another one of those episodes. It's an upbeat episode for the American audience. It's got this warm, you know, 80s nostalgia to it. They even talk about what's called an immersive nostalgia therapy. And one of the white video game players talks about 1980 as a golden age. And that there's maybe even a little bit of like the Make America Great Again, like Donald Trump wanting to go back to whenever his heyday was, whenever he thought his golden age was. I don't know. But yes. Particularly, I believe you said this is Jamie who wrote in. Is that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and Jamie, who sparked this whole conversation. I want to read one line that just stuck out to me. This is Yorkie, the white woman, speaking to Kelly, who's the black woman, who is introducing her to expanding her experiences. It's yet another version of the help me. There's the help me in White Bear. There's the help me demand in Noseside. But this is another one that's framed as a demand. Yorkie says, just help me. Can you just make this easy for me? Right? Here the white woman expects the black woman to do the work of expediting her fantasy. So even in that way, it's like playtest, where the white guy expects the black woman to hook him up to this gear and have him play this really great immersive horror game. It doesn't turn out that way for him, but there's this this expectation that the black character is going to make things happen. And she doesn't ask. She says, just help me. That's a command. And then she later says, you have to show me, right? You have to show me is different than saying, please show me. Would you please show me? I'd like you to show me. Which is ironic because in another scene, Yorkie lectures Kelly about, she says, it's about manners. And maybe you should feel bad about being rude to me. To the credit of the episode, Kelly has some good lines in this one because she says at one point, I owe you zero. The other thing I think that's a really important asymmetry or disproportion in a lot of these episodes is that when Kelly and Yorkie talk, the conversation is all about the white girl, all about Yorkie. It's about her. It's about her experience or lack of experience. It's about her family and her whole story with her family. And as Gusty Renegade said, at the end, you find out that this black woman had been married for 49 years and loved this one man deeply and loved him, only him. He was the one true love. But Kelly actually calls Yorkie on it, finally, on this kind of disproportion. Kelly says, did you think to ask? Did it occur to you? And I thought that was a kind of a moment of truth because similarly in the playtest, you only find out like when the white guy who's going to play the game is interacting with Sonia, who becomes his lover and kind of expands his experiences. He only talked about himself and his relationship to his family and his parents, and you get all that background about him. You never find out anything about Sonia. Same thing here. You find out all about Yorkie, but you don't find anything about Kelly until the end. But in spite of all that, at the end, there's a kind of philosophical debate about what's the right way to think about this virtual reality. And finally, it's the responsibility of the black woman to compromise her principles, to change her mind so that the white woman can have her fantasy. The black woman had made a promise to herself that when she died, she was just going to die. She thought that was the right way to do it. It was the way to honor the love that she had had in this marriage of 49 years. And yet when it comes down to it, Kelly doesn't want that to happen. And so it's up for the black woman to change her mind. She has to come to her. She has to come around to the white woman's position. That's what it seems to me.
I agree completely. Just some of my thoughts on this episode specifically. I find it pretty revolting. I'm reminded of Mr. Nero. I think the last time you were on, he called in and he asked about black males and black females being seen together, working this out. In the 13 episodes that we have of this thus far, there's not one episode where you have a black male and a black female like together as like a couple, a family. I think we heard a similar critique of The Purge, unless I'm going crazy, but not once in 13 episodes does that happen. The only time, in my opinion, that the closest that you even get to a presentation of a black person who is not a moron, a criminal, a buffoon, a servant, is this black female who is here to cater to the sexual needs of a white woman. I mean, and this is supposed to be like progressive television or viewing and what have you. I think a lot of the points that you made, I think, are right on point. I think the sexualization, I think I have kind of emphasized that theme. I know with black males, it's with black people, period. This black female, and I think she's kind of a big star. Like, I hope I'm saying her name correctly, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, like Beyond the Lights, Concussion. These are big films. Free State of Jones, Belle, these are big movies. For her to be in this television series, and she's just kind of sexualized from the very beginning. Like when we first see her, some white guy is chasing her, like, hey, we had sex last week, let's hook up again. And he's chasing her for about half the episode. That, in fact, that's how she meets Yorkie. That's how Kelly, the black female Kelly, that's how she meets Yorkie. Mm-hmm. Is she's trying to flee from this white man who wants to have sex with her again. And I think just that that is black people, again, just being super sexualized if they're not deviant, criminal, buffoons. I think you get some of that within the series as well. And the total disregard for her husband. In fact, I have an audio clip of that as well. The question I wanted to ask, did you make anything of this white woman being named Yorkie? And that even gets brought up in the within the show. She says, like the dog? And she says, yeah, like the dog. Do you make any of that within the context of the show? But since I do have my clips back, I think I got some of them back, but I had the scene where this white woman is so disparaging in how she talks to Kelly about her husband, her deceased husband, and him making the decision, as you said, to not come to this virtual world. But just, I guess, before I play the clip, any thoughts on this white woman being named Yorkie?
Well, I mean, it's part of the sexual play. It's like Yorkie like the dog breed, and then Kelly says to Yorkie, do I have to tug your leash? So there's this sort of this play of that there's some sort of game that's going on there. I didn't get anything beyond that, that it was part of that hypersexualization. And I suppose it does then play implicitly into this theme of deviance then. It turns into then, you know, sex with animals is also then implicit with that.
Why do you think people interpret this as, I got just from reading some of the reviews, why do you think people have the impression that this is a more quote unquote upbeat episode? What does that say to you, that seeing this quote unquote interracial lesbian pairing, that people think that them staying together in this virtual reality after they've both died, that people think that that is upbeat?
I guess. It has, I will say, as sort of in contrast to the tone of just explicit cruelty of so many other episodes, I think people experience a kind of relief here. So I think I said at the top of the show that there's a kind of overwhelming negativity that masks the racism of a lot of these episodes. And here, I think the contrast to that overwhelming negativity makes this seem upbeat and masks the racism in what it seems like a ray of hope. Like, oh, you know, here's a possibility of human relationship, but without acknowledging how imbalanced and unjust that relationship is.
Hmm. Fascinating. They are rumored that they might do a sequel to this episode in the fourth season, which is supposed to be coming out in 2017, to show that things did not end well with this whole pairing. I will say also, for anyone who saw this episode, I did not think that this was a happy ending, even if we get away from the racial component, this virtual after you're mm-hmm. dead, you can stay and hang out together, because they show like the computer that runs all of this. So that's what you end looking at, not this couple, however you feel about that. It's you just end up looking at these machines that virtually have all of these people that are dead, and whatever programs are running to create this virtual space where they're living out whatever fantasy they're having in this little made up town. That's not, for me at least, that's not the type of thing that you would end thinking, oh wow, that was great, that's so it just seemed kind of creepy. The whole thing is kind of creepy in a myriad of ways to me. I had one more question about this episode, but I just want to make sure I don't forget. This series, I think, employs music in a variety of creative ways throughout the three seasons. in the Merit episode, 15 Million Merits, where the white female, where she goes and she sings the song for the hot talent show to try to be a singing star. The song she sings is Anyone Who Knows What Love Is. And that kind of becomes a theme song for the show in a way. So this is in the first season, episode 2. The song pops up again in season 2, episode 3, at a karaoke event where they're singing that song again. And then it pops up again in season 3, episode 5, where a white woman with a gun, no less, she's trying to drown out a man who has been saving these roaches, they call them, these terrible people that they just want to eradicate. He's been helping them. And so they're going to arrest him, and she's trying to make him be quiet or drown him out. So she starts singing this song. So they kind of made this the unofficial theme song of the series. And it's always being sung by a white woman every time. Three different white women are singing this song. I think it's interesting because this song was actually sung by a black female, Irma Thomas. It's Anyone Who Knows What Love Is. She got some notoriety in the Louisiana area. And particularly given what you shared before, I said I didn't know the episode where they took an actual killing, murders that whites mm-hmm. did. They inserted that into the series, but they use a black female to represent this crime that was actually committed by a white man and a white woman. They take this song that's really beautiful, sung by a black female, but they have three different white women who become the face of a song that ends up becoming like the theme song for this series. And I was thinking, wow, that seems like a pattern of appropriating black musical genius, black genius period, and giving it a white face and letting whites get all the benefits for this product of black labor, black technology, if you will. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's a perfect crossover between, you know, the example that I said, in other words, white actual crime gets translated to black guilt in the series, and black musical genius achievement gets translated into white beauty and white joy in the episode. The only thing I would say about the way the song plays out, it's a beautiful song, it's a transcendent song, but it also very much becomes kind of the siren song of the white woman singing to the black man, I think, particularly in 15 Million Merits, because you could see the song in some ways as being about an asymmetrical, or even not necessarily abusive, but yeah, one of the lines in the lyric is, you can put me down, still I'll be there for you. It's all these things that the person can, you know, you can neglect me, I don't need anything from you, and I'm still going to be there for you. So in a way, she, the white character in 15 Million Merits, sings this song. She's appropriated it. She sings it. The black man hears it, and in a sense, he acts out those lines. That he gives everything to her and nothing in return. That he has a kind of unconditional, but particularly asymmetrical devotion to her.
Absolutely. And it's that asymmetrical devotion relationship. Power is expected in these relationships between white people and black people, I think, throughout the series. I cannot think of one that deviates from that, except for the times we've said where it ends up being a part of the plot. Like, oh man, you see what's happened when this gets subverted? Isn't this mm-hmm. terrible? With Nosedive and Playtest, when that, you know, gets upended, making the point of the horror of these sci-fi films. I have the audio, which I want to play just to kind of make the point, because I think the tone that Yorkie takes, for me, it very much reminds me of like The Help, since Bryce Dallas Howard's character has been mentioned, but just the typical racist white tone when they feel like a black person has been uppity or is not doing exactly what they want done, which in my view is exactly what's taking place in this scene, where Yorkie's upset. She's trying to convince Kelly to stay in this virtual world. As Dr. Kevorkian already stated, Kelly explained that her black husband, who's deceased, he rejected this. His logic was that, hey, We had a child. Our child didn't get this opportunity. Since she didn't, I'm not going to take it either. That was his logic for not doing it. So she's not going to do it either. And so Yorkie is upset about this. She's trying to get her to change her mind. Play the quick sound clip, and then we'll be right back. Context of white supremacy.
What is it? You feel bad because your husband isn't here? Because that was his choice.
Don't.
He chose not to stay here. It's like he left you. You know, he could have stayed, but he chose to leave you.
You don't know what you're saying.
You should be mad at him, not whipping yourself with guilt.
Get off me.
You can't see it. But what he did, it was selfish, actually. It's...
So rare to have a moment of violence against a white person in films. Just in my view, that disregard for a half century of marriage, children, all of it, like just come and, you know, be my helper sexually or whatever else that I want. I thought that was the essence of racism, white supremacy from this white woman that we're supposed to sympathize with. Your thoughts, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I think that particular speech is just disrespectful to its very core. And it's not enough that she's telling her, you know, you got to do what I need to make me happy. No, in the process, she's got to defile and sort of ruin the memory that this woman has of her husband and count it as nothing. Say, you know, this man that you thought you loved for 20 years, well, really he was selfish and really he was bad and he didn't care for you. It's really trying to take that genuine love and the memory of that genuine love away from her. This is not something that she, you know, wants her to have because it's interfering with her fantasy. You're right. It is the essence of that kind of demand that occurs when the white character perceives the black character is not doing what she perceives they should. But again, as you say, it does end in a kind of a grim image of all those banks of those. I mean, what she finally convinces her to do is to be, you know, bits in this big bank of servers, which is one of the iconic images of the whole series. Like when you look up, you know, images of the series for series three, that's it. That final image of San Junipero, of all those computers. And the other iconic image always comes up is the Men Against Fire, which is the black man with his eyes looking kind of dehumanized, crawling across this white space in which he's been imprisoned. I feel like, you know, those are really two perfect images for the whole attitude of Black Mirror, like this big, scary, soulless technology that engulfs all of these souls. And then this black man that is being rendered looking inhuman within his eyes. And in fact, we find out in the episode at that moment, he's blind in a white prison. So I got kind of far afield from your comment there. Sorry about that.
No apologies. We hadn't even got that. I wanted to see if I could maybe get a quick word in about that episode, because I think that's the episode I actually took the most notes about, was Men Against Fire, and then maybe Hated in the Nation. Let me even get in White Christmas really quick as well, because I thought that was so important. It's a long episode. It's bizarre, as most of these episodes are. When I stated at the beginning of the broadcast or much earlier, I said I paid attention to the episodes that had white in the title immediately. White Bear, watched it, felt like that was a home run. The racism I thought was clear and, you know, nauseating for many reasons. This episode is similar, but I feel like this episode you have to wait much longer for the racial component to kick in. But when it does, like, whoa. To get all the way to the end of this like hour. And that's another thing. This series, it's so strange. The episodes are not even of uniform length. Some of the episodes are 40 minutes. Some of the episodes are 90 minutes. Like it could be anything. But this is one of the longer episodes, like 90 minutes. You get all the way to the end to find out that this white man has... Oh my gosh, even see if I... This white man, he was in a relationship with a white woman. She got pregnant. He thought they were having a child. She was pregnant. He thought it was his child. He finds out much, much later, years later, this was not his child, that apparently his former white girlfriend had been cheating on him with a non-white male. So the child that he thought was his, when he finally gets to see what she looks like, she is non-white. You would, I guess some people would say, quote unquote, biracial. I suggest not using that term, but he can see that she's not white. And he makes, and this episode is called White Christmas. He gets to the end and he makes a big to-do saying, where's my child? Where's my daughter? Where's my daughter? And he ends up killing this child's grandfather, his ex-girlfriend's father. He kills this individual because he's so upset seeing that this is not his child, that this is the child of a non-white male, which gets back to a lot of the anxieties and things that we've been talking about. Just what are your thoughts about what's revealed in the conclusion of that episode, White Christmas?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, as you say, it's this extremely long episode, and all the buildup is all about, again, it's extended playing upon the theme of cruelty, how people can be cruel to one another in these virtual situations. But a lot of it seems to be about nurturing some kind of sympathy for these white guys, like this terrible thing has happened to them, where people can, what do they call, blank them out, and then no one can hear them or see them. The people that they're in relationships with can do this and just blank someone out. And it seems like it's building up that they have all this kind of righteous complaint against the cruelty of this technological world that they live in. And then it's sort of, then that resentment is then paid off in this act of violence as you say at the end.
I think that's, it's to have at least two episodes and the importance, the first two seasons, it was not on Netflix. This was when it was a higher percentage of the audience, the viewing audience, I would suspect would be British viewers, to have a lot of these same themes. I mean, this is 15 million merits. That's like the tried and true. In my view, that's just an updated version of Othello, basically a black male going crazy over a white woman. That's repackaging for the 21st mm-hmm. century. Moving even with White Christmas, this white man's fear that some non-white person is going to get my white woman pregnant. The core of a lot of what Dr. Welsing talks about, I would submit even the core of a lot of what people have been talking about with the whole rise of Donald Trump. We need to put that wall up. We've got too many non-white people here, getting into a lot of those core fears about the demographic shifts. We don't have enough white people, the growing numbers of non-white people. We're reading Lothrop Stoddard, Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. To put that anxiety of this, I mean, talk about white powerlessness, where I can't even procreate because that has been usurped by this non-white person, and the technology have worked hand in hand to even usurp me being a father of a white child. I think they just make it so clear. And for that to be the climax of the White Christmas episode, which was a special at the end of the year, I think that's extremely important for many, many, many reasons. The last two I'll try and squeeze in before we let you enjoy the rest of your evening. Men Against Fire. So this is season 3, episode 5. This is after Netflix. And I think Jamie and some other people submitted, they feel like you can see many more black people. That seems to be one of the changes they noted. A lot more black characters after season 3, the next Netflix merger. Men Against Fire. They have this technology that you have soldiers. You can give them this technology so you can alter how they view things. Some things you can distort what they see, so they can look at some people and, as opposed to just seeing a human being, they'll see like a ravenous werewolf or something to that effect, where they can monitor what you're seeing. They can upload information. They can alter your dreams and give you these erotic fantasies where you can, they can clone a black female. And so you can have an orgy with, you know, 8 different black female clones. And they're going out to kill these roaches. That's the term that they use. These roaches, these are these people that allegedly have all these genetic defects and they just need to get rid of them. And so they have this, they use the computer technology so that when you see the roaches, the people they call roaches, they look all crazy like beasts or monsters, so they can just kill them. And they say this is because people sometimes are hesitant either to follow orders and kill when they're doing this, or because they have PTSD afterwards. So they're trying to make people more efficient killers, basically. We have this black male. His name is Stripe. Kananga. His name is Kananga. But they call the nickname. There we go. Nickname. They call him Stripe. And he says, because they can't say my name. They can't say Kananga. So they call him Stripe, which I think is interesting in this series for him to get the nickname Stripe. I'll even pause right there. What do you make of the nickname Stripe as opposed to Kananga?
Well, I mean, I wish I'd thought of that example when the earlier caller made that comment about the enforcement. It's perfect. Yeah, it's perfect. That is, I think, a name that I don't know how he got his name, but it's one that tends to it seems somehow a diminishment. I don't know. I don't know why he would be called Stripe, but I mean, yeah.
You have a yellow stripe down your back, maybe? They say you're a coward. That does seem to be a theme of the episode, that there's something defective about his ability to go out and do. In fact, I can play my sound clip now that it's working. So, and keep in mind the white women Trump voters. Thomas in New York asked about that. We certainly spent a good chunk of time talking about that 53% of the white women voters that Donald Trump secured. I think it's hugely important in this episode that is about, you know, the military. We got our armed soldiers. We're going out to kill these roaches. And it's too flat. You should just think niggers when they say roaches. In my view, you should think nigger. They have a scene where they call this guy who's been helping the roaches. They call him a roach lover. That's why I say it's too easy. This one is flagrant. That's what they're talking about is, in my view, abuse of black people. Specifically, when they say roaches, you should think niggers. But the people that are leading this armed battalion are not white men, as we're accustomed to seeing, a la American sniper Chris Kyle or John Wayne. They are white women, very pale, almost albino type looking white women, in my opinion. But they are leading this armed force to go get the roaches. I have 3 clips, but I put them all together because they're basically the same. So it's, you hear the first white woman, her name is Medina. She's in the troop, and just hear the aggression and the way that she talks. In fact, she talks about it's in her nature, it's in her DNA to go out and do this, how she functions as a soldier. That's the first clip. The second clip is a different white woman. She's also a soldier. She's just talking about the logic as to why they need to go do this to hunt and kill these roaches. And then it ends with that first white woman coming back again and just talking about what's in her nature. Pay particular attention to the rhetoric they use when given this description. This is, all 3 clips are from Men Against Fire, the episode we're talking about now from season 3. Dr. Kevorkian, context of white supremacy.
No!
It's Stripe.
Here's a little tips in case you get your first toe-to-toe with one of them roaches today.
Uh-huh.
When you see one right here, try not to shit your pants. It's only gonna piss them off.
I'll try.
Try to ignore Len. His aim's so bad, he's the only guy on Earth who could shit his own pants and miss.
Man, fuck you, farm girl.
Farm girl?
Yeah, hunting's in my blood. Some of us are naturals.
Ruin out!
Yeah. Cross on the wall there. You got principles. Think all life is sacred. And I get it. I agree, all life is sacred, so you even gotta protect the roaches, right? It's not their fault they're like that. They didn't ask for this. I get it. We get it.
Mm-hmm.
The shit in their blood that made them that way. The sickness they're carrying, that doesn't care about the sanctity of life or the pain about who else is going to suffer. We don't stop the roaches in 5, 10, 20 years from now, you're still going to get kids born that way, and then they're going to breed.
Bingo.
And so it goes on, that cycle of pain. That sickness. And it could have been avoided.
Fucking roach nest. You check in there. I'll take the stairs.
Every roach you save today, you condemn God knows how many people to despair and misery tomorrow. You can't still see them as human. Understandable sentiment, granted, but it's misguided. We gotta take them out if humankind is gonna carry on in this world. That's just the hard truth. Gotta make sacrifices.
Whoa, Miss Sharpshooter.
Patronizing fuck.
Ruthless. You the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, well, no roach gets away next time.
Are you still sweating that?
Well, I grew up tracking deer. You never give up. I don't like it when they get away.
These assholes, they always get away.
Nice.
Yeah, if that fucker made it to the forest, probably made it to the border, gone for good. Yay, it's all right for you. You popped two of them. It's been a while for me. You know, the gal is getting twitchy.
Oh, come on, Ray.
You sleep good?
Yeah, I slept okay.
But that's not what you're gonna give me. Okay. You know, if I got two in one go, I would want to come for, like, an hour.
Right, shut up.
Context, white supremacy cameo from George Zimmerman. They always get away. What do you make of it not being white men? It is white women who are in the role of the violent crusaders, the violent defenders of racism, white supremacy, and particularly the rhetoric that they use. It's in my DNA to be a hunter. We have to sacrifice. It is an honor to go out and do this work to preserve our talking about this as a preservation of bloodline and doing this work of killing these roaches. And then the last line where we again get this connection of some sort of sexual gratification with violence. What do you make of white women being in this role where we generally see white men?
Yeah, I think there's a great emphasis on these white women here, the ones that are the warriors, as in a sense being an extension of the imperative of the women in the village. One of the first white women who interacts with Stripe is a white woman in the village, and she has no authority over him nominally, but she basically gives him an order about the roaches. She says, "You must stop them coming." In other words, says, "You must stop them coming. I have a child." Right. So it's about the white mother who is about preserving that bloodline, that pure bloodline to the next generation. And she's giving the order to the black man in the service of that cause. So that's the thing I kind of focused in on, is how the black man is expected to step up and fight alongside these white women and fulfill that same role. When you see the black man fighting alongside the white woman, you understand how true he's been to that order that he's been given to defend white motherhood and white children. And when he does well at that, the first time he kills a roach, or he kills roaches, the white farm girl praises him. And what she says, "Yeah, you're the Terminator." You know, this is something I always go off about, is when a black man is referred to as the Terminator. The good black man who defends the white family is just the flip side of the fear of the black man who is pursuing or assaulting the white woman, that Gussie Rennedy spoke about, came in in White Christmas. Just like there's a bad Terminator who is trying to kill Sarah Connor, then he can be flipped. He can be turned into a good piece of technology, the good Terminator who says, come with me if you want to live, and helps save Sarah Connor and her child in the sequel. So it seems to me that this is an episode about white women uniting to turn this black man into the good Terminator. I think it's spot on. Also, what you said about, for example, the phrase like roach lovers. It's an episode that tries to kind of have it both ways. It's, as you say, Gus, it's so obvious that the language here is about of roaches is about talking about non-white people. But on the other hand, the episode is very careful in its visuals to always show the roaches as having white and white, albeit monster-like faces. So it kind of has this deniability. It's going to speak this language of racial hatred, but it's going to say, look, but we're showing you very carefully that all of these actors that are cast as roaches are played by white people. So it's another way in which it's a very obviously and heavily charged racial episode about this imperative that originates in the white woman to preserve the white family and enlists the black man to kill the roaches. But I think it tries to cover its traces in some of its casting, specifically of the roaches.
Right. We've talked that happens in films sometimes where the character representation will be represented. Like, I think iRobot is an example where Will Smith has a lot of prejudice against the robots. That's a film Dr. Kevorkian and I discussed before, where he's like, man, these robots, they're messed up, they're thieves, they're criminal, and he thinks they're stealing pocketbooks and all of this. And it turns out that he's right. There is something wrong with the robots, where it's not the white person who has this prejudice against the machines or non-white people. It's a black person, where that happens, but it's still enforcing the same general white supremacy notion, which I think is happening within this episode. It's a pretty, I do have the sound clip I could play now, the scene at the end with Arquette, where he kind of spills the beans and breaks it down. And this is another Invisible Man moment, in my opinion, Ralph Ellison getting a little love today, where we again have a black male who doesn't really understand quite everything that's going on, has kind of even forgotten himself. He still has a name, Stripe, but has even kind of forgotten how he's in this predicament. He's just trying to figure it out. It reminded me very much of the main character in Invisible Man, where they are literally showing him video of himself agreeing to this brainwashing procedure and him doing it in a very kind of moronic manner where he's not even taking this seriously, just kind of laughing and joking through the whole procedure. And then when he gets upset about it, they blind him. I think you said that's kind of one of the iconic images of season three where he's in this white cell, literally this room of white, and they blind his eyes electronically with this technology. And he ends up being prone on the ground, whimpering in his, you know, impotent stupor. And then a devastating moment, they end the episode with him in front of like this abandoned house, but they're using the technology they can manipulate what he sees. So he thinks he's at some welcome home party seeing this black female that he's been having all these erotic sexual fantasies about, but he's just in front of some, it almost reminded me of Hancock, another Will Smith film where he's on the moon with graffiti. Reminded me of that, where isolated black male out in the middle of nowhere, and he thinks, he doesn't even know where he is. He thinks he's in I mean, it's depressing. Very, very, this and White Bear, easily for me, two most disturbing episodes in the whole series.
I agree.
Hated in the Nation, last one we'll get a word in. This is the last episode that they've done. This is the last episode of season three. They were six episodes in season three, which originally was supposed to have 12 episodes, but they broke it in half. The other six is supposed to come out next year. I submit it'll probably be a bigger buzz when season four comes out, because it'll be on Netflix and a lot more people will be familiar with it by the time they release all that. So a lot of people could be revisiting this, I guess, to see if some of these theories hold true to what comes out in the coming months. But Hated in the Nation, Dr. Kevorkian got a sound clip for this. I'll play before we get his comments. But as best I can explain this episode, they have all of these people who end up being really despised online for whatever reason. They've done something that has angered people. So people go on social media and are saying, they have a hashtag, I think it's death to, and then you insert the person's name. And so this ends up becoming a contest, and the person who gets the most mentions is killed each day. And so it takes them a while to figure out that that's what's happening with this hashtag thing. And they're using, they have drone bees, basically. They weave in as a part of the plot, the bee problem that's happening. And so they're making these drone bees to go out and pollinate and carry out all of the activities. And someone has been able to commandeer these bees and is using them to kill people that are disliked on social media. That's kind of the plot of this episode, which is also a longer episode. It's about an hour and a half. Dr. Kevorkian got the sound clip from the documentary film Michael Moore, Bowling in Columbine, where he has a fascinating segment about bees, which is immediately what came to mind for me when I saw this episode. This is only like 60 seconds, and then we'll hear from Dr. Kevorkian. This is from Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine.
You know, the thing I love about this country of mine is that whether you're a psychotic killer or running for president of the United States, the one thing you can always count on is white America's fear of the black man.
We've heard the stories on the news and in the papers, and they have killed people. Killer bees, also known as Africanized bees.
I'm scared. I'm really worried with them.
Rosemary Shibley never expected a nest of Africanized killer bees to shack up across the street from her.
But I'm terribly allergic to them, and so are my grandkids.
They're originally from southern and eastern Africa. Dr. Warwick Kerr brought some to Brazil in 1956 and tried to mate them with the European bee, the kind that we're used to. But they got loose, took over, and moved all the way to the southern United States.
The main difference between a traditional honeybee and an Africanized bee is the bee's aggressiveness. If I was to do this to an Africanized bee's hive, I could have several hundred stings in a matter of minutes.
Danny Self raises the kinder, gentler European bees, and he's done the research.
The only way that you can tell the two of them is doing measurements on the body parts.
Kindler, gentler European bees. What say you? How does that segment from Michael Moore's documentary relate to the final episode from season three, where these drone bees are being taken over to kill people?
Well, if you just say how it relates to sort of everything generally, is that I think it's a great example. And often when we talk critically about something out there in culture, and people will say, "Oh, that's not really about race." This is a perfect example of something that I think is not about race, but is so obviously about race, the Africanized bees. Just as even all, similarly, as Gus, as you said, the roaches in the previous episode of Man Against Fire, it wants to say it's not about race, but it's so obviously about race and about, as Michael Moore identifies, about the fear of the black man. In Hated in the Nation, these attacks of these drone bees is consistently figured as a black swarm. It's something that has come up in other techno thrillers. Michael Crichton had a novel called Prey, in which there were swarming nanos, flying nanorobots, kind of like bees, and they would attack. In that novel, it was revealed that the center of the code that controlled this swarm behavior was from African hunting animals. So again, it was this idea that there's some sort of essential African component to this aggressiveness of this swarming behavior. I'll just say I just happened to be in the car today, and I heard an interview with the poet Clint Smith. I don't know if you or your listeners are familiar with him, but he's given a talk on how to raise a black son in America. He's a poetry slam champion. But one of the things he read was a poem called What the Cicada Said to the Black Boy. And one of the lines in that poem was that the cicada says to this young black man is, "Whenever you swarm, they shoot." And so there's this idea in that poem, but I think in a critical sense, but also in this episode,
that there's this fear of this swarming behavior that is identified with fear of non-whites. And again, white powerlessness. One of the central quotes for me for this episode is pretty deep into it. There's Rasmus. This guy is a white scientist. And he says something that he's really saying throughout the whole thing. But it's when he realizes that these swarms have all gone on the attack. And he says, we're not in control anymore. They've got the whole thing. So it's a we and a they. And the we here seems to be clearly, the only people in the room are white scientists, white technocrats, white military people. Although I guess they do have an Asian investigator on their side, and this time can't help them control this either. Just to go to that other comment about the fear of Asians and their involvement in technology here, the Asian man fails to help control this for the white people.
Presses the button to release it. In fact, if I remember correctly, that initiates the sequence where the bees get to kill a lot of people.
So he gets blamed for that sort of mistake. Right, he unleashes it. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, he is held responsible for those, you know, the thing that triggers those 387,000 deaths, or however it turns out to be.
Right. I thought it was significant. They have one of the people that dies as they're figuring out what's happening is this black musician, black rap artist, who's like despised. And it to me, it seems different because they have white people who've done things where they're killed, where people were upset with them, so they get killed. But it seems very different when you have the white female journalist. People don't like her. They don't like the trashy reporting that she does. It seems very different. It seems like there's more sympathy for her death and even some of the other white people. I think there was a white woman who urinated on a statue. There's more sympathy for these people than this black artist. It's like he was mean to a child on television, mm-hmm. and then he's consuming cannabis on camera when he gets attacked, and then he's a rapper on top of everything else in addition to just being black. It just seems like there's not, and the way, it's not just that he gets attacked by the bee. He gets attacked by the bee, and this is a theme I've pointed out consistently, where black people, it's not generally that they will just, you know, get shot and die in a film. It's generally, it will be lots and lots of violence and just levels and levels, mm-hmm. and even after they die, continued punishment. And that's exactly what happens here, where this black man, this artist, he gets attacked by the bee. They take him to the hospital where he's still alive, so you get maybe a little hope that he's going to hang on, but then no, and he dies in the most excruciating way, where they just suck this metal bee out through his eye socket, and then they show that just to really put all the gore into it, like he got what he deserved. No good nigger in here talking bad about these children and smoking weed and everything else. That was one. And then the pedophilia comes up here because we have a white politician who's upset. I think it's the prime minister. He's upset because he has become number one on the list. So he thinks he might be the one that gets attacked by the bees if he is the most hated person for the contest for that day. And he says, hey, we got pedophiles here who should be number one. Why don't we release some of their information? They're like, hey, that was, you know, he wasn't convicted. That was just a rumor. And he says, hey, he did it. And you know, he did it. And just again, for me, that kind of routine normalization and inclusion of child rape and sexual deviance, I don't think should be minimized. I think it could be promoting it on some level. And the last point I also thought was important, the sexualization of non-white females continues in this episode. They have a journalist, Michaela, where she goes and she is trying to get information, right? And so she goes to the bathroom and she takes off her top and sends pictures of her bosom exposed to one of the white guys who's working on this problem to see if he'll leak information. That's not this episode. That's the first episode, the national anthem episode. But that is important, just continuing that theme of the sexualization of non-white female characters throughout the series. I guess with Hating the Nation, that was everything I had to get there. Let me double check with Lashes. I see you still on the switchboard. Did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? If you did, I wanted to get you in. If you're just listening, that's fine too. Did you have a question, Lashes? Are you just listening? Might be listening in. She might be just listening. I'll assume she is. I got through all my questions and was hoping we would not keep you as long as we did with The Purge. Any final comment, anything we missed, or anything you would like to leave listeners to think about this series before we let you go?
Well, I'm just grateful to you once again for having structured it and led us through this so productively. I'm thankful to your listeners. I don't think I have any comment other than that just to underline how this hated emanation really does, with coming back to the chance of the Prime Minister, it really comes full circle from, you know, national anthem to this one, to the sort of the fear of power, white powerlessness at the very highest level, and that black blame is involved in this. The woman that I thought about here, I agree that the woman who urinates on the statue is ultimately end up portrayed kind of sympathetically, and we see her standing in kind of white sisterhood. It's another one of those moments. There's the three women that go together in the safe house, and they're standing side by side, and they're going to make their last stand. Whereas the black characters, like the rapper and the school teacher, are both kind of isolated in their moments of victimization. And the black woman, you know, the school teacher character that I'm talking about?
Oh, right, that, right.
She's the one who is blamed for starting starting to target the journalist. Right, then she becomes much more of a target of the episode. Her name is Liza Bahar, and she says something like, "I was just using my freedom of speech," and she rightly points out that you know, the whole thing was crowdsourced, and there are like 80 other people who gave money to send the cake, and she says, "Why don't you blame them?" And the white police women who are kind of giving her a hard time, they don't have any answer to that, but they only blame her. They only give her the citation for it. They don't pursue it to these other people. So she is being very disproportionately, I felt, singled out for her guilt in that murder of the white journalist, who thereby, as you say, even her, she is made more sympathetic by the way the person who is portrayed as being responsible is shown.
You get to hear from her moaning, grieving husband afterwards, and, you know, how terrible this whole thing was that he saw it. And I don't see that sympathy extended to, I don't think anywhere throughout the series, I don't see that type of sympathy extended to any of the characters. Certainly not in White Bear. Certainly not for Stripe. I don't even think Bing, that's the black male character in 15 Million Merits. I don't think he's even... I'd be interested to see what people think about his character, but I can't imagine people sympathizing with him a whole heck of a lot. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that Othello really nails it, and people often talk about the nobility of Othello, but it's still always, it's a tragic nobility that betrays him and drives him mad. So it's there seems to be no reward in it.
Orange juice, man. OJ.
I love that.
Oh, that's even, I hadn't thought about it. OJ Simpson. I hadn't even thought about that. But, maybe one to think about as we exit. Some listener posted a link. If you have Netflix, you can just watch all this online. All three seasons are available. I don't think you'll have too much difficulty. And my suspicion, I could be in error, but I think this is going to be a very popular series. I could see this being on for some years. I think the whole technology thing, as you stated, this is like a critically acclaimed series. So it's already got a lot of backing. Netflix is involved now. I think this could be something that's on for some years. And maybe people, if you are hearing this down the road, you can see if some of these tropes continue as the series remains on the air. I would submit they're probably going to be the case. Number one, these are just fundamental elements of entertainment under the system of white supremacy. A lot of these ideas you'll see in lots of different programs. It doesn't matter what part of the world. But for this particular series, I've seen enough of the episodes at this point. I have no reason to think that they're going to deviate from what they produced the first 3 years. At any rate, Dr. Kevorkian's book again, color monitors, the black face of technology in America. I think it will definitely relate to this series if you've seen it or plan to check it out. And as he stated, drop him an email while supplies last. He would be happy to send you a copy of the book. So drop him an email. You can go to his faculty page at the University of Texas, Austin, and you can see his email address. He already gave it out in the program. Drop him an email, get him the book. It is a very interesting read. We've discussed it on the program before, and you might learn something about racism and entertainment. Always grand having you on the program, Dr. Kevorkian. I know a lot of our listeners always enjoy hearing your expertise, and for this series especially, great hearing your insight. Keep up the great work, and we look forward to having you back on the program soon, sir.
Thank you so much, Gus. Thank you, Mr. Renegade. Have a good evening.
Thanks, sir. You too. Enjoy yourself.
Take good care.
Context of White Supremacy. Again, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, been on the program a number of times down through the years. Really interesting insight, particularly those type of films. I'd say like the kind of sci-fi genre, deal with kind of technology, robots, that sort of thing. Pretty interesting observations. If any of our listeners have a quick question or observation you want to get in, people that saw the show or any of the episodes we discussed, if you have something quick that you want to ask or get in before we ride out, feel free. I have seen all of the episodes, so I can give a quick comment, or if you just have a question about something you heard from Dr. Kevorkian, that's fine too. Anybody have anything they want to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Praz. You mentioned the significance of in the episode Men Against Fire, Stripe. So I was just looking that up. And Stripe is also the name of the mischievous gremlin in the old 80s Gremlin series. And also, and here's the thing, what I've noticed, and I start noticing this in when I start watching Breaking Bad, when they have names of characters, it's not just a name. It's really a significant, like, it's like they have, maybe they have like an internal dialogue for white people who actually catch the reference. So Stripe's actual name, right, I'm looking at the Wikipedia, is Coinage, which is sort of an anagram for coinage, which means token. So he's like a token black person. And if you look up, you look up the word stripe, right? So stripe is like, it's like meaning like one color. And if you look up stripe, you look up images, it's black and white. So I was thinking to myself, like, black and white, what's the significance of that, right? Black body, white identification, white eyes. And he's literally blinded in whiteness. So, like, when they have these names of these characters, there's always a significance there. They don't just name it just randomly. So I just thought that was interesting.
Thank you, Praz. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Names are super, super important. Stripe as well, because that scene comes up specifically in the film where he gets asked by the white character who ultimately blinds him at the end. Arquette is his name. Why did they call you Stripe? And he just says, because they can't say Konanga, I think is how he pronounces it. But yeah.
Konanga. Yeah, but it looks like coinage to me with the N. They just put an N in there. Which means token coin.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I read it as coinage when I first saw it, and it's the O I like in coin. You know. Yeah.
I think the female character's name Rayman, right? Is it Rayman?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I was looking at that, and I was like, Ray of light. Are they trying to say she's a representation of a white man or Aryan? Light, ray of light. Aryan man. I was trying to figure that out too, because they have all kind of anagrams in these different television shows.
For sure, I think one of the other female soldiers in that episode is Medina. I think is her name, which has some major significance for the Muslim religion. But I think that's one of the white females' names in that episode, the prominent ones, right? That's like leading the battalion. Other folks, quick, anybody else? Question they wanted to get in, comment what they heard about the discussion, anything they needed to get in?
Yes, can I hear it?
Yes, sir.
This question was for you, Gus. I was wondering if you knew of the trailer. The movie trailer is a movie called Get Out.
I'm aware of it. I haven't seen it, but I posted it. It's like, from what I've seen, it's some sort of, looks like a horror type film where it's a black male. He's in a tragic arrangement with a white woman, and they're doing some sort of like ritual experiment on him. It seems like they're luring black people, perhaps black males specifically, to this house for this whatever type of terroristic ritual or whatever they're doing, where they're killing them or maiming them in whatever way, and him trying to find this out and escape. That looks basically like the plot of it. I haven't seen it, but yes, I saw it, at least the trailer, the promos and such for it earlier this year. And it just looks like the same type of racial theater, I think was the term Dr. John Hoberman used, who's also at the University of Texas, Austin. That was the term that he used. That's why I said I think that sort of racist imaging and just incorporating that into the plot of a lot of television programs and movies, that's a very common practice. That's why I say that, you know, reading is more important, because you could just do this forever. You could watch all kinds of movies and TV shows forever because the racial dynamics are always there.
Okay, yeah, because I had a family member actually send it to me. They know how I always talk about racial matters and stuff like that, so they sent it to me, and they was like, I think this would be interesting. And I clicked on it, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, wow, this is crazy. So I just wanted to know if you had knew about it. That was my only question.
Hold on. The caller at 5448, did you have a question, observation?
Oh, just a quick comment. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus. Good evening, and good evening to the listeners. I just wanted to say that before, I didn't want to lose sight of the continued theme for black people, particularly the black male, how successes are only deemed success in the system of race and white supremacy when they are negative and unconstructive. Your successes should be, things that undermine, any sort of constructive pursuit in the pursuit of justice. And I just thought that strike, doing the bidding of this white power structure, killing these people who are deemed roaches, that's when he's successful. But he's malfunctioning when he's not doing this. He's malfunctioning and needs to be fixed. Same thing with the relationship. He's only functioning correctly when his relationship with a black woman is fantasy. It's not real. It's just a figment of imagination created for him. The reality is that there is nothing in his life that is a positive connection to a black woman. The 50 million credits, this black man, worked so hard to use all his credits to try to help finance this white woman's career. And, once that's not successful, he goes and gets more credits and gets a television show where he rants pretty much ineptly and impotently, because he's not changing anything in the society. They put him on there sort of as a clown show, listening to this ranting black male ranting going on about society, but nothing's going to change. He's just really just running his mouth. So who cares? The other one, poor Chester. Chester is a successful black male only when he's dating Gordon, another male. He's engaged in his anti-sexual, homosexual relationship. It's only successful then, but once he breaks up with Gordon, nobody in the office likes him. He's downrated to the extent where he gets kicked out of the building because he no longer has a job, because he's no longer in a anti-sexual, homosexual relationship. And it doesn't matter how nice he is, how well-dressed he is, how congenial he is. He's still a failure for not being in this anti-sexual relationship. His personality and character traits otherwise are meaningless, no matter how nice they are. He's only successful in this relationship. So I just love those things there, keeping in mind, because they're just continuous themes in the system. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Is it okay if I just underline one thing about 15 million merits? I think that's so true.
Absolutely.
The other thing the other thing that he does, he not only rants, but what he is essentially doing is his success, as this listener puts it, his success consists in staging a self-destructive behavior. His success, his stardom comes from continually staging the scene of his own suicide. He's holding that shard up to his neck the whole time. That's what people are watching, that spectacle of self-destructive behavior. That's his success. So it's exactly what that listener just said.
Reminded me of Network a little bit, too. If people remember that film from the 70s. There was the listener, I forgot, she had two questions. One of them was, what do you make of San Junipero being filmed in South Africa? What did you make of that? And then Rashida Jones, who is Quincy Jones' daughter, she does have a white parent, Quincy Jones, black male, famous musician. She has been on a lot of different television programs and what have you throughout the years, but Rashida Jones, not white male, that she is one of the co-writers for Nosedive, the episode with Bryce Dallas Howard. What do you make of her involvement with that episode, and maybe was she trying to say something overtly about racism?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think that it's still a script that's put within the framework that Brooker has set up for what the expectations of Black Mirror episodes are. But I don't know. And it'd be interesting to think about, is there a kind of truth telling that occurs through that episode? Even what is being said about, look at what happens to Chester. Are we being asked? Is she asking us to think about that very consciously? These things can all turn with a kind of insight like that. Well, maybe Rashida Jones is up to something with that script that I haven't previously given it credit for.
And San Junipero being in South Africa, any thoughts on that?
Well, Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that if it's, particularly if the filmmakers are anxious to have that known, it seems to play into this idea of the utopianism of it, that this is a dream of, racial unity. This is a dream of harmony, of something that is a blow against apartheid, right? That here we're stating this relationship between a black person and a white person in a place where that previously was legally segregated. So I think that might be there to try to generate good feeling about it. I don't know. That's just a very loose speculation, I fear.
I know. Appreciate that. Glad we got Jamie's questions in. Anybody else have a question they needed to get in? Folks satisfied?
Oh, I just had one more question for Dr. Kevorkian. So in 15 Million Merits, the female interest, her name is Abby Khan. Physically she looked white, but with the name Khan, was that suggesting that she was some kind of mixture?
Huh.
Or Abby Khan. Abby Khan. That's how she introduced herself.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the name. I guess it's, I'm thinking about the Wrath of Khan now, but I don't know what that name would signify. I know just as the actress, what's her other big fame is like Downton Abbey as like some aristocrat, white woman. So I didn't stop to think that she could be anything other than that. But
yeah.
I don't know. There are sometimes, episodes, series that are set in the future where they deliberately try to mix one kind of first name with another kind of last name to just kind of suggest a kind of blending of identities in the future. I know the people who did the series Minority Report talked about deliberately doing that. It would always take a first name from one tradition and a last name from another tradition and have them both be different from the apparent race of the character, just to kind of suggest a kind of fluidity there. But
yeah, I've heard Lothrop Stoddard mention the term mongoloid, right? And I looked that up, and it was saying like descendants of Genghis Khan. So I was just thinking, is she on the fringe of being Caucasian?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
there's, but again, and that gets into when you really get into the science of it. I mean, there's no racial purity here. I mean, who is not descended from Genghis Khan, right? Isn't that one of the things that he's got, like, more descendants than you can possibly calculate? But
the female in Playtest, the female that meets with the white male character that gets him into the experiment. You thought she was a non-white person?
Yeah, I thought she was. She's also the woman who is the first singer. She appears twice in the series. She's in the 15 Million Merits episode, and she sings. She's the one that the Abby character wants to be like. She says, like, I want to be as big as whatever her name is, the woman. And that woman, her big hit that you hear her singing is I Have a Dream, which seems in the context of this show to be a kind of a degraded or superficialized version of kind of like taking all the air of racial justice out of the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream. Bing himself later uses those phrases, I Have a Dream, but uses it kind of sarcastically in this situation where everything is about spectacle and scene, but not about justice. But I guess the actresses portrayed a variety of characters, but it said on her page that her father was a Nigerian surgeon. So I gathered from that she, you know, had some non-white identity to her. But you're saying she didn't read as being non-white to you.
I wasn't sure. I'm a victim of racism. I was not. I wasn't sure. When I saw her in Playtest, the accent was kind of throwing me. He's traveling, right? So I thought she could have just been, you know, like an Australian white person or something else. I wasn't quite sure, but looking at Hannah John Kamen, I guess is her name. I hope I'm saying it correctly, or at least in the ballpark. Her actress page, she looks like a non-white person. I would have to see her again in episode one, and from her IMDb page, she will be coming back in season four. So everyone can look for when she pops back to see if they think she's classified as white or not white or what role she's in. That would even be interesting to see, to kind of compare the roles that she's had in the series. Look out for where she pops up at next year.
I wasn't sure about that one. What does it mean to be sure? Yeah.
I think you're correct. Non-white female. That's what it looks like to me. I will assume folks are satisfied. Everybody good? That ample time. It has been a hoot. If I certainly will state it again, reading is more important than watching television. I'm sure you can find a book that will give you more insight on some of the things that we have discussed or will push us in the direction toward permanently solving this problem. But, you know, if you have a free moment and want to check it out, I think there's some interesting things to note in Black Mirror. And it might even be, you know, just worth paying attention to see if this becomes more popular, which I've, you know, stated. I think that could be the case, but we'll see what happens with season four and however long it stays on. We will be here, I believe, on Wednesday, documentary film Indefensible. This is about, I think, One of our many callers down in the Florida area told us on Saturday about the University of Albany situation, where it was a group of black female students. They reported that they were victims of white supremacy. They had been mistreated on a bus by white passengers. There was video of the incident. Hillary Clinton commented on this. This was back in like January, February of this year. Ultimately, the police did not charge any of the white passengers on the bus. They charged the black female students with making a false report. They faced disciplinary action at the University of Albany. Two of the black female students were suspended, and they are facing criminal violations for this as well. I've been checking. I think the court case is still pending, but there's a documentary film that's just kind of laying out what has taken place over the past almost year since this all began. And we'll have the filmmakers with us on the program this coming Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I'll post some links so people can refresh if you don't remember that case from earlier this year. We'll be here Friday, the book club, Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, Session 6. I think we have two and we're done. Hopefully it has been helpful and maybe even offering further insight on how Donald Trump won the White House. But with that, if you have other questions, if you have guest suggestions, if you have problems finding something in the archives, just drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Monday evening, and we will be back in about 48 hours. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.